Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Super Nerds in Color. Starring Justin Savakis, Zach Birchie, and featuring Mike Toole and Daryl Surratt. Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. Justin's here.
Hey everyone.
And welcome back to another fabulous episode with our good comrades at the grand table of super nerds. It's Ian and columnist and beloved internet personality, Mike Toole.
Hey guys, what's up?
And another beloved internet personality.
I sense air quotes.
Oh no, beloved is the word.
Yeah, sure, yeah, absolutely. I would definitely describe that. I'm just joking, but from the Anime World Order podcast and Otaku USA, it's our friend Daryl Surratt. Daryl, thank you so much for coming back on.
Always glad to be on. It's been so long, like 5 months.
Yeah, it's been a while. People really like these episodes, so maybe we'll be doing maybe three of them this year. I don't know, but at any rate, I mean, not a lot of news. It's that time of year where basically every entertainment industry is kind of in cruise mode. Video games, not a lot of them, not a lot of anime coming out, not a lot of, movies kind of shut down for award season. But I'm sure everybody's been watching stuff. So I kind of want to just jump right in and see what you guys have been checking out since we talked to you last time. What really stuck out in your mind? And Mike, I'd like to start with you. What have you checked out lately?
All right. Well, in the new in the season that has just started, the winter 2013 season, there are only two shows I'm really into at the moment. One of them is Chihaya Furu season 2,
yeah,
directed by the great Morio Asaka, and it's living right up to the legacy of season 1. Continuity is nice. It's a great little kind of quasi sports, quasi shoujo little series, and I'm glad that we got a season 2.
I was going to say, is season 2 of that another full, because season 1 was 26, right? So is this another full 26?
I'm assuming it is. Honestly, I haven't looked into it.
I wonder.
I'm actually impressed that that's got at least a vocal online fan following, not a huge physical in-person seeing people being crazy over Chihaya Furu sort of following.
Well, the story that
shows like that are a dark horse, but I like it.
Yeah, well, the story that I've heard is that the show has not performed well in terms of TV ratings or DVD sales at all, but there's been a noticeable uptick in manga sales, so at least in one respect, it's working out. And yeah, I'm thrilled. I thought for sure there would not be a season 2, and it would be one of those, all right, you got to read the manga, but there's no manga in English.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it would be like the Hajime no Ippo only for Karuta.
Don't open those wounds.
Yeah. The other show that I've been watching, which I'm sure Daryl is watching it too, because he's retweeted about a little. This is the most important show on television now for all mankind, and that show is Inferno Cop.
Okay, I have not seen this.
Inferno Cop is available for everyone. It's on YouTube. There are even like little caption subtitles. It's basically like a Japan version of a weird ass Adult Swim show. I mean, honestly, it reminds me an awful lot of Axe Cop, the webcomic, in terms of just weird, dumb stream of consciousness storytelling, really, simplistic to the point of hilarious animation. And it's created by like a 5-man team supervised by Hiroyuki Yamaishi of Gurren Lagann fame, and it's over in 5 minutes and it's hilarious and fun.
I will definitely have to check that out. Is that some kind of, is someone just uploading it to YouTube and putting subs on it, or is that actually
It's a legit thing. It's I don't know if it's part of a block, but the brand ID for it is something called Anime Bancho.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. I didn't know that existed. Cool. Anything else? DVD, Blu-ray, anything?
As I've pointed out on Twitter, and this is going to be gone into in great length in an upcoming column, I'm trying to absorb the entire Key and Kyoto Animation pantheon.
Mm. How's that going?
It's going all right. I got through Air pretty quickly, which was the first of their collaborations back in, from back in 2003. I found that pretty mediocre. I went through all of Canon or Canon or however the hell you pronounce it. I think it's Canon. Anyway, that surprisingly had some good qualities, and I'll talk about that more in the column. And I'm just past the halfway point in the first season of Clannad. And that has
this
a few good points.
Is the second time you've had to watch Canon? Because you did that video.
I did that video, but that was based on the first four episodes. And a lot of people took me to task over, you know, judging the series unfairly on the merits of those first four episodes. And, you know, part of the exercise in this column is, you know, I'm trying to understand the beast. So I'm going to watch all of those shows. And I'm going to watch Tamako Market this season, because that's the latest, you know, Kyoto Animation deal. And it's been an interesting journey. I can see the appeal of these shows, and I can articulate it to an extent. I don't necessarily share it, but it's been an interesting journey, and God, I hope it ends soon.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing to me is that Clannad After Story for the longest time was the number one top rated all time anime according to the Anime News Network Encyclopedia ratings.
Yeah.
Recently unseated by Steins Gate, which if Hope Chapman is to be believed, and she's been talking about this on Twitter, is just a key show with a bunch of, you know, in quotes, science in it. And so it's not hard to see why that's the appeal, and it's also based on a visual novel. I guess that's not super surprising, but I didn't know that that had happened until somebody pointed out, hey, Steins Gate's now the most highly rated masterpiece level thing, according to people on the ANN encyclopedia. So,
you know, that was
the
part of
the undeniable power of the semicolon trilogy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was Steins Gate Robotics Notes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was part of why I wanted to jump on these shows, was because the fans of these franchises are really ardent, and you know, I'm just trying to find their point of view and experience it, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's you know, it's interesting. Some of the animation is just absolutely amazing. They especially in Canon, there are cuts from that series that are just like, wow. If they could make an entire series of that quality, it would be, you know, it would be damn good. And other than that, on the pirate channel that I occasionally indulge in, I've actually stopped watching AKB 0048 because yay, that got licensed.
Yeah,
I was only four episodes into that one.
The first season.
Yeah, the first season.
I've you know, when I did the the spotlight for the second season, there were so many characters, and like, you know, so much of those character details were here is how tall she is, here's her blood type.
Yeah.
I couldn't really
just like the real band.
It's just like the real band. And yeah, I saw that one of the Twitter questions was concerning the show and like which was our favorite member, and I could describe the character, but I had to look her name up because I couldn't quite remember it. Because that's how many characters there are.
Yeah, well, my favorite character is Ushiyama, the super offensively flamboyantly gay stereotype dance choreographer. I think he kind of steals the show.
I haven't even gotten into him. I mean, if we're going to address that question now, my favorite is you know, Linda, the nerd with glasses and the weird nickname.
I have not even touched this thing. The only reason I was thinking about it was because of, obviously, Shoji Kawamori.
Yeah,
and it is definitely the next coming of Macross Frontier, as it were.
Yeah.
So it's the Macross show that I've been wanting since the last one.
That's
it is unabashedly and unashamedly weird, and it believes in itself so much that if you just stick with it, you'll start to believe in it too. It's something interesting, something to behold.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to the Blu-ray that's coming. I'll watch it that way.
It's not an Idolmaster sort of show. It's more of a girls with lightsabers and robots sort of show.
I would not expect Kawamori to make an Idolmaster or Love Live type of show. I would not expect that. That would just be depressing if he just made one of those. Here's a bunch of cute girls. Pick your favorite. They're going to do cute things for 10 minutes and then sing a song and dance for you.
this is Footloose, the show.
Okay, great. Oh, fantastic. Awesome.
Oh, totally. Totally Footloose.
So did someone ban idol singing?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh,
like, like Revolution X, you know that old Aerosmith
game? Hey, Daryl, music is the weapon.
Exactly. So. Music
That's
is.
That's exactly right.
Holy shit, I haven't thought about that in years.
Yeah, yeah. And let's see. The last thing I'll mention is I watched an episode of the show Firestorm today. Anyone even know what that is?
Nope.
Mm.
Awesome. It was conceived back in the early 2000s, didn't make it to air until 2003. It was from an idea by the late Gerry Anderson. Essentially a vehicle to capitalize on the, you know, long-standing popularity of Thunderbirds in Japan.
Right.
And the cartoon itself is kind of G.I. Joe-ish in terms of production quality and complexity. It's a real obvious, simple little family adventure story. It's fraught with controversy, and I'm working on a column on that, too. Anderson, for a variety of reasons, wanted his name taken off of it.
Oh, really?
But, and, yeah, the show has become pretty hard to find. A couple of episodes of it were fan-subbed, but those aren't really out there on the net anymore. Well, there are no YouTube clips. There aren't much in the way of Nico Nico clips, so I just went and got the DVDs, which I got used for about 300 yen each.
How old is that?
The show aired, it was animated in 2001 and 2002. It was supposed to go to TV in 2002, but it was delayed to 2003. And it was one of those, it aired once and it was gone, and that was it.
Okay, so then, because my first question was, wait, if this is recent, and Gerry Anderson, that must have been his estate then. Not because he's now passed, but because he had dementia for the last 10 years of his life or something like that, right?
Yeah, no, this was just before he kind of had to step out of the public eye. This was one of the last things he worked on.
Interesting. Huh.
Yeah.
I'm curious to read about that.
You will soon.
And I will. Awesome. Okay, that's a pretty good run of stuff there. Daryl?
Well, I guess the most recent thing that I did that everyone can see is up on the Otaku USA website. We did a sort of a 2012, you know, best of picks sort of things. And, you know, like I've said on my previous AnCast appearances, I'm pretty bad at doing that. But this is what I thought at that specific moment. And I, you know, went crazy and picked AKB0048. but that's over there on the website to check out. Argue over the picks as you may. Also, I've been going through a whole lot of older anime right now because I'm working on a bit of a project that's been going on. I think it might actually be in the Twitter questions regarding the golden anniversary of anime as the year 2013, depending on how you want to count it, could be the 50th year anniversary of anime. And so a blog project has started up, in which case a bunch of superstar columnists and bloggers and podcasters and such are picking years and going through them. I got 1980, so
I got 1975.
Nice. By the time this episode comes out, I believe, or shortly after, Dave Merrill will have 1969 up. So I am going through and I'm watching, you know, the classics from then. My article doesn't go up for another month, but hey, I like to be prepared. So that's been taking up a lot of my older anime viewing stuff. I am watching newer stuff. I'm always watching newer stuff, for the record, Mr. Twitter guy. I mentioned JoJo's Bizarre Adventure on the Twitter. Unfortunately, still not licensed, but it's fantastic, as usual. Wish it had a little more animation budget, but they get around it. Of course, the second season of AKB0048 is legally available on Crunchyroll right now. So I am checking that out, along with some of the shorter things. Guta Guta Fairies Season 2. You know, I know Dave from the Astro Toy column is a big proponent of that series. He turned me on to it. I never would have given it a second thought otherwise. But I'm really glad I did, because that's another Adult Swim caliber show in the good sense, as opposed to the Adult Swim show in the, you know, we had a bag of chips and, you know, a weed, and we made a show kind of show. It's largely improvisational comedy. It's very free-flowing. I think the style of humor I would best liken it to would be akin to those old Captain America poser pictures that people would make. I know, Mike, you're a particular fan of some of the fan animations that people would make with that. That's sort of what Guta Guta, the vibe that it's sort of going after. You wouldn't think to watch it based on the premise of the three cute fairies who, you know, can't really use magic that well, but the fact that it's so free form and it's so absurd and weird, I've shown it to people at conventions who had no idea what it was, and after each panel everyone would be like, what the heck was that show? So I'm really glad it got a second season, and I am checking that out. Chihayafuru Season 2, I actually have not watched because I'm on the fence of, do I really want that ulcer waiting from week to week for that next episode, or do I want to burn through it all when it's done? Which is actually the subject of a podcast guest appearance I was just on for the Speakeasy podcast. It's all about debating the merits of watching things week to week versus marathon stuff. So between that and the video games and various non-anime manga-related pursuits, that's been eating up a lot of my time.
Excellent. Okay, sounds good. you'll probably be able to comment extensively on one of the things I'm going to bring up here. But Justin, what have you been checking out lately?
Well, as we announced last week, I have a new column, so I've been watching a lot of old stuff for that. I have about five titles ready. So most of those I can't really talk about, but the two that I can talk about, because I've decided I shouldn't write a column about them for various reasons. The first one is actually a very recent OVA, which is why I decided I probably shouldn't talk about it. Should probably keep it a little older. This one is called Spelunker is a Teacher. Has anybody heard about this?
Nope.
I know the title. I've seen it pop up on, Pirate Channel trackers, but I haven't seen it for myself.
Right. Well, fans,
I didn't actually watch it.
I'm not sure I fully understand why this exists. In a nutshell, does everyone remember that old 8-bit arcade style PC game called Spelunker?
I do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it was impossibly hard, and basically you just died constantly.
Yeah, it was a Japan version of Battletoads.
Isn't Spelunker considered the ultimate Kuso game, the shit game that they sort of romanticize and idealize really shitty, really, really difficult old games like that? And that's
pretty
the first
much.
One. That's considered the first one. I think I remember that being a thing.
But. I mean, it's so frustrating. If you land on a downward slope, you die.
Yeah. When we were in Japan, Justin, it was going through a bit of a renaissance, and there were Spelunker toys. It was like an anniversary or something.
Right. Well, what they ended up doing is they ended up redoing the graphics and releasing it for on PSN Network.
Mm-hmm.
And it did really, really, really well. So now, they made. A year later, they made this OVA where they imagine Spelunker as a high school teacher.
This I gotta see.
Well, when you're making anime, you write what you know, and what you know is anime high school.
Right. And it's based on a four-panel manga, which, you know, the humor in those usually just eludes me entirely. This I kind of get. It is really, really weird and off, and... basically the joke is he is just this guy in jeans and a t-shirt and a lighted hat. And, you know, all the thugs are, you know, constantly sizing him up. And he just, if you just shove into him, he dies. So, you know, at first everyone's just horrified by this, but slowly everyone gets used to the idea. And it's these little vignettes that don't really add up to much and usually are just too deadpan to be funny in the slightest. Some of them are actually pretty damn funny, though. And what I really enjoyed the most is that it slowly lets on the fact that Spelunker has post-traumatic stress disorder from every time he dies. So he just gets really, really kind of skittish about everything. It's kind of dark, but with a big happy face.
That sounds pretty good. That sounds like something I want to check out.
And it's just a half hour, and you know it has a cute little opening and ending theme, and it's a trifle, but it's worth a half hour, I'd say.
Cool.
Yeah. So there's that, and on the other end of the spectrum, a Korean. I decided not to write about this because it's almost hentai. And it's also Korean, so it was already on the edge.
They made hentai in Korea? I thought Korea was like, you know, frighteningly Confucian about that kind of stuff.
Well, it's not like it's really, really hard etchy.
Okay.
I would put it. Like it's no tentacles or anything.
I see.
But it's called Blue Seagull. And it is the biggest piece of crap I have seen in years. I was delighted by it as much as I was horrified.
Oh, boy.
Is that like Blue Seagull, like the bird, or Seagull, like Katie Seagull, or Steven Seagal? Like what's the deal?
I don't know.
Like, how's it spelled? I mean,
it's like Seagull, like the bird.
Okay.
I thought you were asking about context clues, and there I couldn't help you because it makes no fucking sense. But worse, it's okay. Let me try to explain this. It opens. First of all, it thinks it's really, really freaking awesome. So
I've noticed that trend in bad Korean animation that tends to think it's really, really awesome, which kind of makes the viewing that much more painful.
Opens with a giant, you know, electric guitar riff and this woman just kind of sitting on a motorcycle trying. And I think the intent is that she's getting off from it. But it's so poorly animated and so, like, over-articulated that it just looks like she's having a seizure on a motorcycle.
Cool.
Then it opens with this woman who's a, you know, detective and, you know, she's getting ready for a day. And then it cuts to, you know, her driving to work. But all of the car stuff is inexplicably CG, except it's like 1990 CG.
Yeah, I was going to say, how old is this?
Yeah, 1990, maybe a little, you know, give or take. Her car is orange, with orange windows and shiny. It looks like a hunk of jello.
Cool. Does it have a great big 01 on it like the General Lee?
Not quite, but it's basically downhill from there. It's a whole gangster, you know, seedy underworld type story as Korea seems to be obsessed by. But holy God, is this a train wreck. I couldn't make it through more than 5 minutes of it because I wasn't drunk. But
I'm just fascinated that the quality of CG cars in anime hasn't really gone up in the last decade and change that it's been a thing.
Oh, au contraire. This makes the first season of Initial D look like frickin' Gran Torino 5.
Gran Torino 5?
Gran Turismo 5. Wow, my brain is on another planet today. I'm sorry.
I want to see Gran Torino 5
featuring reanimated Clint Eastwood. That would be I want that.
But anyway, so you couldn't make through much of it.
No, I couldn't. It was too painful. It was subtitled, and something like that really needs a terrible dub.
Wonder if there's one out there.
I don't know.
I found dubs to some of those. I didn't know there was a dub of the original Taekwon V, but I found it. Yeah, it was on VEOH.com. It was called like Voltan or like something with the word volt. And it exists, and it makes a silly cheap ass cartoon even sillier.
Okay, so mostly you're just going through material for the new comic.
There's a lot to go through.
Yeah, sounds like fun. I have been watching.
You would have dropped everything for, you know, watching the latest Shauna OAV.
Well, clearly you know me very well.
I do. I'm listening every week.
No Shauna for Justin.
Yeah, not for me either. So I've been watching stuff, and want to get back in the habit of doing full-length reviews, which once you get off that bicycle, a little hard to get back on. It takes you a while to write again.
I know, right? Like I'm actually having that trouble with the column, because when something doesn't really, really move you, it's actually hard to come up with a lot of things to say about it.
Yeah, I mean that's typical, like in general, even if you're, you know, writing, you know, a couple of thousand words a week or whatever, if you don't have anything strong to say about something, it's gonna be hard to write about it. But this is just more a matter of like actually shaking the rust off and sitting down and writing the full length review. But in the interest of doing that, I am in the middle of my review of Mass Effect Paragon Lost, which I know, Daryl, you wrote about, and had some things to say about it that I generally agree with. Mostly in that I'm not sure good enough is good enough for these things, for these big, lavish co-productions that they really need to do well. And
yeah, they need to knock these things out of the park, and when they just do something that's serviceable, given the high profile of the license, that's unacceptable, and that really hurts the image of anime overall.
Yeah, and, I kind of want to call Madhouse out for the Marvel anime, because they had their top tier talent involved, but they weren't directing. They were at the directors were all from the kids table.
So Mass Effect, it's the least objectionable co-pro I've seen so far. It's perfectly fine. Okay. It feels like, now speaking to someone who has played exhaustively the Mass Effect games, all the DLC, multiple times at this point, I've played them all twice, and all of their DLC and everything, big fan of that franchise, love those games.
Likewise, me too.
Same.
This feels like DLC I didn't need to download. And it's also, the biggest problem with it is, and you guys know what I'm talking about, this is answering, first of all, it's taking a side character no one cares about, James Vega. Didn't care about him in Mass Effect 3 at all. Just total nonplus. Like, okay, yeah, it's Freddie Prinze Jr., who cares? And then put him in a story that is just repeating stuff from the second game. So in this game, effectively, what you're getting is, who are the collectors? Where are these ships taking all these humans to? And they're asking these questions we've known the answers to for 3 years.
Yeah, I think the Mass Effect extended universe in general is not handled well. The comics, the novels, and so on and so forth. There is an infinite number of very interesting stories that you can tell that definitely happened regardless of what player choices got made in the games that don't involve Commander Shepard whatsoever. There's lots of backstory to these characters and to this world that could be some pretty fascinating stuff, and they continually decide to not tell those stories and tell stories that either don't need to be told or nobody particularly was chomping at the bit to hear that story be told in the first place.
Yeah, and this is literally just rehashing shit from the games. So it would be kind of like, oh, we're going to make a Star Wars prequel that focuses entirely on why they're building the Death Star and what exactly the Death Star can do. Well, we already know that. So you don't need to be asking those questions again. And it also feels like any tangential and I understand the desire, like, okay, well, this character was actually in the games, he's got a celebrity voice actor, and, you know, eventually he winds up on Shepard's team, and then any other side characters we might be able to cram in there. I think Liara Tassoni has, like, a line of dialogue in the film.
Oh, boy.
And that's the only other character that's connected to the actual games.
There's Anderson, but again, you know, these people don't have their original voice actors tied to them either. It's just Vega.
I'm pretty sure that's Keith David, isn't it?
It's totally not.
Is it totally not? Credits. Oh, man. Then my hearing is going. Because I was
they
like,
got a Keith David alike? It's not like Keith David is expensive. Jesus.
Well, see, here's the thing.
Well, he was too busy doing Cloud Atlas, Mike.
Yeah. I looked at the cast list, and I think you're probably right about that, because I think it was close enough, and by the end of the movie, I have to be honest, I really wasn't paying that close attention to it anymore.
I actually thought it ended very, very well.
The ending was...
But I went into that in my article.
It's like why James Vega has PTSD, basically. That's fine. but I looked at the cast list, and the top billed guy is Freddie Prinze Jr., and then it's Todd Haberkorn, Vic Mignogna, you know... Heirs, you know, Funimation voice actors after that. And I was like, really? I guess maybe that's how they saved money on the voice cast. I don't know. Like, through the whole thing, I was like, this is fine. It's just barely good enough. And why couldn't this be more than it is? And it's certainly a hell of a lot better than the Dragon Age thing. Even just from an animation standpoint, the animation's not great, and I'm kind of convinced that these 2D renderings of the Mass Effect characters don't look very good. I don't think James Vega in the movie looks really anything like the James Vega model, and the Krogans don't really look like Krogans. It looks like kind of a really simplistic, sort of flat-shaded version of a Krogan, and I don't think it looks very good.
It ties back to what Mike was saying, in that this is ostensibly a Production IG animation, but this is not the Production IG that made Sengoku Basara or Ghost in the Shell or Eden of the East.
Yeah.
These are like people you've never heard of, who've never been given a shot, and Japan really needs to understand that this is not the time to give your rookies experience on these co-productions. These are the times that you have to bring out your biggest guns. and they continually choose to not do that, with the one exception being years and years ago, the Animatrix.
Yeah.
Part of the reason that was so great is that they really got the best guys in the best studios to work on that stuff. Well, and
to a certain extent, yeah, they did that.
I'm not a huge fan of Matriculated, but you know, everyone's got their favorite.
Right.
And they did that. They did that to an extent with Gotham Knight, but you know, of course, they kind of screwed that whole project up.
Yeah, the editorial meddling and producers and what have you wanted a little too much oversight. They, you know, we've heard the stories, you know, the rumors, but yeah, this, all these things, you know, they all could be good. And what seems to happen is that I walk away thinking, well, that was okay. But when you're making an X-Men anime, it needs to be way better than that was okay. It needs to be like reminding you of how you felt when you first saw X-Men 2 in the theater.
Right.
Or at least this is a super cool alternate look at X-Men, like an alternate angle on X-Men that's really artistically different, and it's kind of blowing my mind that that these characters can be imagined in this way. Like, that to me seems like a little bit more of the goal than just repeating or just saying, like, okay, well, it's like when I saw X-Men 2 or whatever.
Right.
I mean, just the feeling you got
exactly,
is like being engaged.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, but I'm just going to finish my thought here. I was imagining that. Sure. I don't think anyone in Japan really gives a fuck about Mass Effect, and that's why this is the way it is. But everyone in Japan gave a fuck about The Matrix. Like, it was the biggest thing in the world when The Animatrix was being made. This is before the sequels came out and kind of ruined it for everybody. But that was huge in Japan, too. So I would imagine that's when those directors were like, oh my god, I can get involved with this thing that's huge here. But Mass Effect is not really a thing in Japan, as far as I know. So, I mean, Batman, not so much either, I don't think. So...
Well, who wrote it? That's the real question.
I believe somebody from BioWare wrote it,
yeah.
But they credited him as a guy who writes a show that I like quite a bit, The Clone Wars. He's one of the writers for that cartoon, which is a astonishingly violent cartoon,
right.
And it's quite good. But he's maybe not the main guy. I don't know exactly which specific episodes he wrote, because I would have to check IMDb for that. But yeah, it wasn't a Japanese guy who wrote it.
Mm.
And I don't think it was a BioWare employee either, but they do have that final say, you know, the Mac Walters type guys over, yes, go with this, no, you can't do that sort of thing.
You know, the thing about co-pros like this, where, you know, you have one hand in Japan or one foot in Japan, one foot in here, is it's already so hard to make lightning strike. And when you're dividing the labor like that, where nobody really has complete ownership, I imagine it's really hard to really put forth a new striking idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like, again, it's not a bad movie at all. Like, it's totally.
Yeah, the biggest flaw is just the story they chose to tell. If they had chosen to set that story and be like, this is what happened to Garrus on Omega between Mass Effect and Mass Effect 2. Okay, that's an awesome story. People want to hear that story. This is Thane's background as an assassin. This is how Zaid got betrayed. You know, that's the kind of stuff where it's like, okay, this is interesting. Or here's the first contact war between the humans and the Turians. You know, if you want to go back even further than that. But it's always like something really goofy that nobody really wants. Like, there's a comic that's all about how did the elusive man get his eyes?
Yeah.
What's his real name?
What?
Don't you understand this takes away fundamentally what makes that character interesting?
Yeah.
Apparently not, since that story exists.
The elusive man is Martin Sheen. That's who it is.
Yeah, it's President Bartlett in the future, yeah.
It's not President, it's Martin Sheen, the actor.
Yeah, no, I know. But, like, that's the thing, though. Like, this story feels like they were kind of trying to have it both ways, where it's like, okay, the fans know some of these characters, and also we can tell kind of an, ooh, military guys tragically die in this mission story that sort of feels like it might have a broad audience, but no one who doesn't care about Mass Effect is gonna... If you don't care about Mass Effect, you have no interest in this movie, and it's not for you anyway. Like,
I think the time to release it would have been just before Mass Effect 3 came out.
Oh, totally.
As
opposed to the timing was way later. I was saying that back when they announced that it wasn't going to be coming out before the game.
I can't believe they didn't even hit the Christmas window. I was shocked when they moved it from like Thanksgiving weekend back to the first week of January.
Oh,
it's like, oh
yeah.
Man.
Well, we had
missing out on like 30% of your sales there.
Well, we had Funimation on and said, hey, why, what? And they said Walmart. Walmart said put it in stores on the 28th, and so they did.
Yeah, well,
Walmart's extremely powerful.
that's a horrible reality of the retail business. What Walmart says goes.
Yeah, it is. But at the same time, I do hope this does really well for them. I think it's a fine effort. I don't think it's a great movie. I think it's just okay. And it's kind of a shame that it's just okay, and I wish it weren't just okay and not offensive and generally kind of entertaining for a little bit. And it's a little repetitive, and like when you said it, you're not sure whether or not it was a BioWare employee that wrote it. It certainly feels like it has the exact same cadence as a DLC pack, like as a side story, where it's dialogue options and then combat, 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 dialogue options, combat, 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 end. it definitely feels like a DLC side story, but anyway, so my review of that will be up at some point, and I basically just summed it up.
If we didn't already tip our hands by what we just said.
Yeah. The other thing that I've been watching, and later on the slate I've got Blood Sea, which I'm only watching because of that Colony Drop article that made it sound like the most batshit, mean-spirited, horrible thing in the world, so I totally went
I did open my Otakon Craziest Deaths last year with Blood Sea, and that's kind of all anybody remembered was what I opened with, because it's that out there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting to that. But I'm finally watching Mawaru Penguin Drum, the Sentai Filmworks release.
Yeah, man.
So this is Ikuhara. Extremely Ikuhara, and even though he hasn't made a show in too long, in my opinion, he has not lost it. It's a good show. I'm only about 7 episodes into it, and this set only has 12, but I'm really enjoying it. It's a lot of moving parts. The story is insane to describe it. Basically, has anybody here watched this?
I was waiting to watch the show when it was all released here because I knew from my Utena viewing experience how much more I got out of it when I was able to just consume it all in one shot and see how everything really fits together rather than one episode a weeking it. And so the first episode came out in Japan. I watched like an episode or two fan sub and I said, okay, that's it. I'm buying this once it gets licensed and coming out here. And then nobody announced it forever. And then finally, it's coming out. And I was going to wait until the second set came out and then go through all of it. So I haven't really gone that far.
Right. And
I had the exact same experience.
Okay, yeah. So you all were doing the same thing I did. Yeah. that's. I was like,
I was waiting too.
So the show itself, I could say, like, this is only the first 12. And frankly, the reason that I'm not waiting for the second set to come out is because I'm going to review it. I'm really enjoying it so far. The story does have a shitload of moving parts. So many moving parts, in fact, that I'm halfway through the set, and they're just now introducing what I think is the villain. So that was 6 or 7 episodes of setup. Really fast-moving setup with a whole lot going on. Like, at no point is it boring. It's just the story has so many pieces. Two brothers live with their sister in this house, and their sister's terminally ill. And they go to the aquarium one day and buy this penguin hat, and she puts it on, and then falls over basically dead. And the hat effectively brings her back to life, so to speak. And it turns out that there's some sort of sentient alien thing that's inside this hat that is keeping her alive for the purposes of finding the penguin drum. It delivers to them 3 cartoony alien penguin helper guys that real people can't see. So they're great gazoos, right? So the only main characters can see them, and they're magical alien helpers.
Penguin stands.
Yeah, right.
Do they all look like, are they the penguins from Madagascar?
No, that would be horrible. But and so it goes from there, and it gets weirder and weirder and weirder, and there's even more characters than that, and even more moving parts, and it's a crazy show. I am really enjoying it so far. But as I mentioned on Twitter earlier today, and it kind of lit Twitter on fire for a couple hours there, this is a bad release from Sentai Filmworks. The picture quality is fine and everything. There are commentaries from Ikuhara on the Japanese Blu-rays. Those aren't in there, of course. And it is basically dub titled. And the show is dubbed by Stephen Foster. So
now wait a minute. You actually turn on the subtitles and they match more or less?
Okay, so when I watch a show for review, I watch it dubbed with the subtitles on, presuming that there are not 2 different subtitle tracks, 2 different translations or whatever. I don't think I've ever seen one like that. But
Funimation usually does that because they have their subtitle tracks unintuitively labeled English and Japanese. But Japanese is English subtitles for the Japanese track. English is captions effectively for their dub.
Do they still do that? Yeah, I don't know that they still do that, but
their authoring is weird.
Everyone's authoring is a little different.
Well, at any rate, this doesn't have that. I checked, because before I was even going to say anything, I was like, wait a minute, do I have the wrong subtitles on? No, I don't. And it's not a one-to-one match. It's not, like, people on Twitter did mention this, like, maybe it's like a weird, it's like a hybrid dub title plus whatever they thought they wanted the subtitle track to be. So it's not a perfect one-to-one match, and there are differences in the dialogue. This might be the script versus the lip flap actual dub that came out. So, like, they're using different takes in the dub, and so that's why it doesn't match perfectly one-to-one, but generally it is one-to-one. And the English dub is full of dumb American slang and weird translation choices, because it's Stephen Foster. So, internet jokes and dumb slang and all that shit is all over it, and that's also in the subtitles. And I was really looking forward to watching this show, and I can't tell you how disappointed I am that I'm stuck watching this version of it, because I don't want this translation. I want a real translation. I don't want Stephen Foster's wacky internet jokes. I want the real thing. And that's what's really upsetting about this whole thing to me. I wish they'd have just put a faithful, straightforward, no stupid joking around, no you're not taking it seriously, no give a shit that nerds like us like this dumb crap, or whatever your attitude is towards it. Yeah. Just give us a straightforward fucking translation. Some of us like this stuff.
It stuns me that, you know, with almost two decades at this point of a pretty steady mantra of just please don't alter the original version. Please don't alter the original version. This shit continues to happen.
Well, it's not. I don't care if they alter the original version. Just make sure it's available.
Yeah, that was my fundamental objection back in the Streamline Pictures days. You know, that, okay, yeah, the dub would change up a bunch of stuff and whatever. But the real problem was that you didn't have the choice. It was that or nothing. And as soon as I actually started to get the choice of having the original one, then suddenly I can look back on those Streamline dubs with some nostalgia and appreciation, because you know what? I got the straightforward one right here as well. And then I can go wild with, you know, whatever craziness they decided to do on their English version. And so that softens the blow. But when you don't have the choice, when it's like, okay, it's the Stephen Foster dub, or, you know, kind of still the effects of, you know, all that goofy ghost stories, whatever stuff.
Yeah.
Then you get annoyed.
And I need to make sure to point out that this is not like a ghost stories. It's not a total rewrite. They are rewriting some of the characters, because I was posting examples of the subtitles on Twitter, and some folks were telling me, like, oh, that's not what that character is supposed to be saying there, and it also changes his characterization. Because one of the brothers, these two brothers, one of them is supposed to be kind of a reformed playboy who's decided that he's bored, basically bored with women, and isn't a lech or a perv or anything, but he's got a lot of, in the dub, he's got a lot of pervy, lechy kind of lines. You know, the biggest example at this point being, at one point, they're monitoring a stalker who's turns out to be a major character, but the camera mounted to the penguin looks up her skirt, and in the dub and in the subs, he says, "Hey, panties for the win." And I put my head in my hands and said, "There's no way that that's supposed to be the translation."
Oh boy.
Yeah, it was already bad enough when the tagline for Sekire was "Boobies for the win," but it wasn't in the show, at least.
It's not in the fucking show. But again, like, these are minor things, and I'm not saying that it destroys the show, and I will watch the entire Sentai release. I do not imagine they'll send me the second volume after complaining so much about the translation on this one, but I'll watch their whole official release, and it's fine, and I'm understanding what's happening in it, and it's A-okay if you just want to get the gist of the show. I just wish there was an option in there for the non full of dumb jokes and slang translation. And it's not like every line is like that. They play the straight scene straight, but it's not what I want, you know? Like, that's not how I wanted to watch that show, but whatever. It's a good show. People should totally check it out, especially if you really like Dutena, because it'll remind you of that a lot in many different ways.
Kind of hoping they, you know, they fix the subtitles for the complete series release.
I doubt they'll reauthor. That doesn't happen that often. Yeah, it's expensive.
Not only do I doubt they'll reauthor, I'm pretty sure that this was one of those, hey, there's a few people on the internet who said they want it, so let's dump it out.
Isn't that their entire catalog?
There are some that they take more care with, like Ninja Scroll, and, you know, shows that they expect to sell better. But this is you know, in 2013, this is a B shelf release. It might have prestige with folks like us who really love Utena and really love Ikuhara and are just really, really curious to see his new work, but I don't think they had sales expectations for this beyond us, which makes even less sense that this is the treatment they would give it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, from what I've been hearing about what's going on at Sentai, I mean, look at their release, the amount of stuff they release.
Yeah.
They've got to be just burning the midnight oil over there. It's got to be, I can't even imagine pumping out as many discs as they pump out. And if they're just trying to just keep the pipes going and, you know, they're probably working their people really hard.
Yeah, I've heard some stories of some like notoriously short turnaround times they want on some of these translation projects. And maybe for something like Penguin Drum, where there might be some complexity to it, and they said, hey, you know what? This script is close enough and we're under the gun, so we may as well go with it.
Just slips through the cracks. It's a, you know, new junior producer or something. Who knows?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we've speculated on this, and I have heard that it is not an inaccurate speculation that their goal is to have a gigantic library so they can sell to streaming places. You know, have a nice big library so Amazon's interested. Have a nice big library so Netflix is interested.
Yep. And to be sure, the stuff that is dubbed, a lot of that is because, well, they're turning around and selling the dubbed version to Animax Asia and other overseas cable outlets.
Right. Yeah, it's a volume operation.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're not going to slow down and take a whole bunch of care with our weird, you know, small audience, arty kind of silly, you know, show for fans who were around, you know, in the 90s or whatever.
Maybe if the Penguins fought in Vietnam.
We'll talk about that later.
If the Penguins were anthropomorphic girls with huge tits that all fell in love with one guy,
we'll talk about that later,
then,
too.
Then it would be different, too. Apparently that's what's selling. But anyway, so that's what I've been watching. My reviews over the next 2 weeks will be showing up on all that stuff. But let's go ahead and get to Twitter, because we got a lot of Twitter questions here.
Oh, boy.
As usual, lots of Twitter stuff. Okay, Hazukari asks, in a battle for wackiest Tomino name ever, who would win and why?
Does Full Frontal count as Tomino's? Because that's my pick.
I mean, that's middle of the pack. What about Full Flat from Elgheim?
Oh, my God.
Kitty Kitten from Ideon? Aren't you watching Ideon, Daryl? Wasn't that 1980?
Yeah, I have to go through Ideon. I've seen Ideon before, so you know
there's
stuff is maybe bouncing, like, you know, not really as ridiculous as the notion that they named him Full Frontal without realizing its English context. Except the entire reason they chose the name is because it was an English term sounding name. That kind of sums up the approach to Gundam design in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and from Zabungle, like the pilot of the Great Big Mecha is this big muscly dude named Fat Man Big. Which is great, because he's not really fat at all. He's, you know, he's definitely big and he's kind of gruff, but he ain't a fat dude. My pick would be Shot Weapon from Dunbine, because he is a weapons. He's like a weapons and technology guy, and his name is Shot Weapon. That's like fate worked out perfectly for him.
Okay,
it's like naming your daughter Aphrodite for the whole purpose of making her a stripper.
Now they just call them Amber,
right?
Candy Star, yeah. Okay. Asriel Newtype asks, what demon have you been worshipping to get Cobra and Pat Labor relicensed on the same day as a new Ghost in the Shell series is announced? I don't think he means
it has been a good news week for guys like me. I'll give you that much.
I've been worshipping Shub Cartoonieth, the black goat of the woods with 1,000 OVA sequels.
Yeah.
I'm delighted by the Cobra news, and I am kind of mystified by the Pat Labor news, even though I'll be pre-ordering that.
I think all it takes is,
Yeah.
You know, when you see those prices that they want for that original OAV set, I'm really excited for that. But yeah, I mean, I'm just glad that finally all these titles that I wrote reviews of years ago or did podcasts of years ago are now actually coming out and people can go watch them. So I can just link people. Oh, yeah, I already covered that one. Go back to 2010.
I really hope they redub Pat Labor. I'll take the Stephen Foster dub. over yeah, what we currently have.
Did they dub the original OAVs at all? I thought they only dubbed the TV.
Absolutely. No, they dubbed that whole thing. And the only thing I ever remember about is the dub is that the guy that they got to play Asuna
should have been Ota.
Yeah, yes. That, and Dave Merrill pointed that out, yeah.
Oh, I got some stories, dude.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you can tell they were just reading the script. Not really any direction. I think
Director didn't even show up to the sessions.
Yeah.
It was literally them with the engineer in the booth with the subtitle script, adding words when necessary for padding.
Like, you know, and stuff. Sheeg.
Right. And also...
Because they pronounced Sheeg a Sheeg. That was the joke there.
I am so pissed. Because that pet labor lives and dies by its characters.
Totally.
It's rich characterization.
At the very least, I've got the excellent subtitle track and the Japanese audio. Imagine if it was only that dub.
God.
No, I refuse.
Yeah, that's not pet labor. That's a mess.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I don't know, like... The outfit that decided to pick up pet labor, I'd never heard of them before. They're doing things through Sentai. So, yeah, more power to them. I hope it works out well. I hope enough people can support the pet labor OAVs that we get Blu-rays. And who knows?
I feel like that Made in Japan outfit is another, like, former ADV shell company or something. But
gee, you think?
Regardless of who they are, I'm very happy that they picked it up. And Jesus God, you know, Pat Labor OVAs on Blu-ray for like $25. That's ridiculous.
I hope they do better than we did, because we couldn't give that shit away. Nobody.
I'm just amazed. It's a testament to the quality of that show that it never ever really did well here, but we got all of it.
Yeah, and Justin, you have to remember that you couldn't give it away. No one wanted it because that was, you know, single discs for $25 a disc and really kind of dubious DVD quality, kind of dubious dub quality. I look at a situation like that and I just think if they can give it all away in a single release, maybe it'll find an audience and sell.
Oh, the OVAs we did as a single release.
Oh, really? That was just, wow, okay.
Yeah, no, the whole, yeah.
After the VHS days.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, don't get me wrong, we fucked it up, but we didn't fuck it up that badly. There was, and honestly, I think a lot of it was the box art, because we had shit for box art.
Yeah,
yeah, there isn't really the kind of, you know, key artwork sort of stuff for Pat Labor when you go to the Japanese ones. It's a lot of it is the voice cast or things that, you know, wouldn't suffice. So I remember those CPM covers that they got some guy to draw, like, Goto with a gun or a sniper rifle or something like that.
No. Those weren't some guy drew it. Those were us trying to trace these terrible 35mm screenshots that we had that were so grainy and dusty that they were just these blurry messes.
And you guys just had to try and make a vector drawing and hope it didn't look too bad.
Exactly. And it usually did. Like, we had nothing. The Japanese releases actually had these gorgeous Akemi Takada, like, pastel pieces, but...
So just Noah.
Oh, no, everyone. There were like gorgeous shots of Azuma. And, you know, if you ever see the Japanese LD collections, they are gorgeous. But no, we couldn't get any of that. We asked for it and they just said flat out no.
Man.
That's Japan for you.
Yes, it is. So Godspeed.
I wonder why people don't buy it.
Godspeed Made in Japan and Sentai. I hope to God you get better materials than we did.
Maybe they will. Maybe it's now old enough to where, you know, they're like, fine here.
Akemi Takada always cares.
Maybe they're at the point where they realize enough decades have passed that their big super hit show that was like a domestic hit that isn't really something that the rest of the world wants to see, that you don't hold out for the big money or whatever, that you can just sort of give that stuff out for a reasonable price, and that's why we're starting to see so much more of this coming out now.
Oh, yeah, I definitely feel that way about stuff like Cobra and, you know, Discotech's other slate of, like, Cutie Honey and Mazinger Z. I feel like the licensors in Japan and these small publishers in the U.S. have finally figured out the arithmetic, you know, to where both parties can make a little bit of money and, well, at least the stuff isn't going to sit there on the shelf and gather dust.
Yeah, I mean, at one company that has a big catalog that I know of, there has been a little bit of a shift in the managerial structure that has resulted in some major cleared pipes. So it's a good time to be an old school fan, that's for sure.
Excellent.
All right. From Daryl Bunau, he asks, if you can rewrite history by eliminating an entire genre of anime, what would it be? And what good or bad anime would be lost for the better? So it's kind of a complicated question. I don't really have an answer for that. I know what he wants. Probably wants.
I think he's setting us up for a specific response.
Yeah, setting us up for a specific response. But I, you know, understanding the realities of business mean that I would not say like I don't like moe, so let's get rid of. No, like people have kept the lights on and food on the table by producing moe, so I wouldn't say go back and get rid of that.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. I like moe. I like Galaxy Angel. I like Haruhi Suzumiya.
And, do you like one of the second, like if not the third OAV ever made? The really skeevy Lolita porn.
Lolita anime. I haven't even seen that, dude.
Actually, that's my vote.
I know it by reputation.
Pseudo-pedophilia hentai,
The entire like first wave of hentai OVAs, like any one of those would get you put on the sex offender list for having it. I'm serious. What? It's one of those. I've seen some of that stuff in like late night convention video rooms, and that kind of shit would just make the room empty out, you know?
I don't remember Cream Lemon being that bad.
Cream Lemon had a couple of installments that were pretty out there, if I remember, involving like obvious children. Or, you know, maybe I'm conflating it with something else. Either way, it's
you got it on the mark.
I haven't seen much of it, so I wouldn't know.
My answer is that I wouldn't eliminate a genre. There's good stuff in every genre. What I would do is try and get rid of the bottom tier, like the lousiest 20 or 25% anime that gets made that just makes the medium look like crap, and allocate all the resources and money used on that stuff to make the rest of it better.
I think I have to agree with Justin in that not necessarily a genre, but the entire notion that, hey, we can put sort of, you know, pedophile fantasies in animation and it's going to sell. Like, if they had just never figured that out.
Not technically illegal.
It would have. I feel like we'd be in a better place, at least.
They haven't gotten around to writing the laws that we're breaking.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. If that whole strain had just stayed the fuck away, man, and it hadn't been so closely tied to, like, a bunch of different hit shows and all this other stuff. Yeah, it would have been nice if that shit had just fucking stayed out. But you know what? You can't rewrite history and whatever. It's certainly, like, moe is certainly not what I would say. Like, yeah, let's get rid of all this because that would be stupid.
People like that. It's business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I had to make a fundamental change, it would be to rebalance the distribution so that, you know, maybe certain shows didn't dominate quite so much. I mean, you know, maybe in the 80s it was a whole bunch of, you know, one type of show, and now it's a whole bunch of another type of show. And maybe if everything was a little more evenly distributed, you know, the wars would be a little less vehement, and there'd be something for everybody more often.
Yeah, I mean, I still maintain my argument that fans like us get plenty every year. There's at least one or two things per season that people like us could be interested in.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No doubt at all.
And that's fine. That's totally fine. And, you know, it would be like expecting all of American television to be what you want it to be, or even half of it to be what it is you want it to be. Like, you know, it's a medium, not a genre. So, yeah, I don't know.
And all I'm saying is, when you look at the slate and you say, wow, I'd like there to be more variety in my medium. But as long as I got my one or two shows, I'm not screaming a lot on the internet. Yeah.
I'm telling you right now that, like, this winter, I looked at the slate early on and was just like, man, this is not looking good, but Inferno Cop makes it all worth it.
Yeah, hey, man, I gave Love Live! School Idol Project a 4 out of 5.
Wow. Only 4 out of 5, Zach? I have words for you on this one.
I mean, for really silly reasons, but I gave it a 4 out of 5. Hey, she dances in traffic at the end.
that sounds pretty great.
Yeah. Okay.
If only it was played that way.
Yeah. Blob Guy asks, this year seems to be starting strong for anime fans. I think he's referring again to the Pat Labor Ghost in the Shell thing. Is this as good as it can possibly get? Well, no.
I sure hope not. Feed me more.
Yeah. No, no, as good as it gets. No, what we need for it to be as good as it gets is for anime to get like its mojo back, the cool factor. It totally had that in like the early 2000s when Cowboy Bebop was on TV, when Metropolis was in theaters, when the Animatrix was being produced and there was actual big time anticipation for it. Anime is very popular. I mean, people get down on it a little, and it's just like, no, you don't understand. Like everyone, people, you know, millions and millions and millions and millions of people love anime all over the world. It's just stigmatized
and not considered a cool thing.
Exactly. I would like to see that return, but that then things would be about as good as they could get. But the way things are going now, I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, I think things are fine.
Although I would argue that this, you know, big rush of really, really old classic titles is only possible because it's not popular right now. Or, I mean, the sales seem down.
That's an excellent point.
They know that, hey, we don't have to charge $75,000 an episode for Getter Robo. You know, now we can actually see some more things.
Exactly. We would have never gotten Cobra 10 years ago, ever.
Yeah, they would have been like, oh, no way, Cobra. This is a huge hit all throughout France and Italy and what have you. You jack up that price, you know,
to infinity. You need to spend at least $1 million just to license it.
Exactly. So let's clear the catalog first. Let's get all the classics. Then we can start making money again.
Sure.
Okay. Youth Nile asks, any chance of Mike and Anime Warlord are discussing more of Tomino's masterpiece, The Bison Well Saga?
I got the Wingsarene right here.
But so do I.
Aside from Mike and myself, there's literally nobody else willing to watch through them with us.
I'm telling you right now, Wingsarene, you could go to Amazon Marketplace and bag all three of those discs for like $15 total with shipping. Yeah. And they're, it's a high-quality product. The animation looks great. Every disc comes with a booklet. I haven't watched it lately, but I made it most of the way through it. It was completely incoherent, gloriously incoherent. And I would love the chance to talk about it. So
yeah, it's too bad there was no Garzy's Wings style dub to accompany the Wingsarene.
You guys are making it just sound irresistible.
Oh, it is.
It is. Yeah. You have to see it.
I have to mention this, that every time that show comes up, which is this is the first time in 5 years or something like that that I've even heard the name. I was just thinking about this the other day because I was watching the Golden Globes, which take place at the Beverly Hilton. Which is where the giant, no, not giant, but the big Oniamis Bandai Visual launch party was that I was invited to.
Oh,
I was literally the only journalist there.
You got to tell us about this.
Yeah, well, so they held it in the Beverly Hilton, not in the big ballroom, in like one of the side ballrooms.
Sure.
But I was like, yeah, whatever, Bandai Visual. So I showed up in like a jeans and a, you know, a button-up shirt or whatever, like, you know, but everybody was there in tuxes and shit. And it was catered, and they had champagne, and then they ran a clip reel of what they were going to release, and they're like, don't say all the titles that we're showing here. And one of them was Wings of Rian, and no one in the room knew what the fuck it was, and I didn't know what it was. You just
nodded along to what everyone was saying, you know, and tried to say yes around mouthfuls of their prime rib.
Yeah, and exactly. And I sat at a table with the guys from Elastic Media. I don't know if you remember them.
Absolutely.
I was like, do you know who you're talking to? Yeah.
I said that facetiously, but like they were there and they're like, yeah, we're totally working. You should interview us. Like, we're working on Pat Labor right now. It's like, okay. but that they spent a lot of money on that event, and I remember like being like every Japanese executive in the room was like, oh, you're here from the press, like really excited that someone from the media was there.
They're always expecting like the New York Times to show up.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It still happens.
Even to this day when there's con guests and their tech come by, like whose interviews to accept. And they're always like, what do you mean the Washington Post isn't, like, lining up to see me?
Yeah, really. Those visits hold a press MO for a decade.
Yeah, that's finally – that actually is finally starting to change a little bit. But we still get it. Like, we still get treated like second-class citizens because they thought Rolling Stone would give a shit. or
seriously, come on. Yeah, the Bandai Visual guys, the top-level execs I met were just adorably clueless. There was one year – when this company was still going strong, when they had released Gunbuster 2. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, they spaced the releases out about a month apart, but they sent all the screeners along to me, care of the convention, because I was doing the video scheduling. So I booked them all. And then Tatsunori Kono, who is the CEO, shows up to talk, and he was kind of alarmed because he was just like, wait a minute, why is the whole thing on the schedule? And I had to like gently explain. They're just like, you sent me the whole thing and gave permission to use it. So I booked them all. And he asked me to have them removed, and I did. I put something else in there. He actually, you know, very gently and politely, but insisted that I give him the DVDs.
Yeah, yeah, they were like that.
Just to hang on to until the end of the convention, then he would give them back.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, they were the kinds of people who would ask you to mail back the screeners afterwards, and the ones they'd mail you were scratched and unplayable anyway, so go ahead and have them back.
Yeah, I mean, Aniplex does that now sometimes with their, you know, when they literally just don't have anything in the home office to mail out, and it's like, we have check discs, and that's it, and we need those. That's our only extra copy.
We actually need those,
It's not a matter of, like, oh, we don't want you to have this. Like, no, it's a matter of they have one copy, and they want to get more press coverage than just us, so...
I think the real sign that Bandai Visual was clueless on that release was the fact that they changed the name to Gunbuster 2. If they had just called it Diebuster, I think that would have helped immensely, because how many people had even seen Gunbuster 1 at that point? Not a lot, because Gunbuster wasn't released yet. And then to say nothing of the fact that Gunbuster was decades old, or the fact that Diebuster is significantly different from the first one and therefore not very much of a proper direct sequel.
Spiritual successor, but yeah, they don't have a whole hell of a lot to do with each other.
Yeah, I think if they had not called it Gunbuster 2, that would have been another starting point for them.
No, that's a good point, but I could swear they put out Gunbuster before they put out.
Oh, they might have. Just prior to.
Yeah,
just prior to. Like literally a month or two prior.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. That was a nice set. They put out really nice sets.
Oh, they put out great releases. They put out great releases. They overcharged like crazy. I will never have all of those Super Robot Wars original generation DVDs.
Oh, man, I found one of those in my trunk.
Never. Which one?
I can't remember. I think it's volume 3. I don't even... I'll look at it.
I got a random volume, but I don't remember which one.
If it's something you don't have, I'll mail it to you.
I need volumes 5, 8, and 9. And 5 and 8 are kind of reasonably priced on Marketplace. They're $30 or $40. But, of course, the final volume in the series, that's like $100.
Of course, yeah.
Right.
Anyway, moving on. We got to get to the rest of these. Next, from Nocturne123 asks, which type of anime do each of you prefer? Original works like Ergo Proxy and Razaphon, or adaptations?
I think adaptations are more likely to be consistent in quality level because they're typically from something that was at least a success in a prior medium. But when I think of like the best ever anime and I actually start looking over what I've thought up, much of it seems to be originally made as anime. Things like Macross, Gundam, Yamato, Cowboy Bebop, The Wings of Onihami is really cool. You know, you go down the list. A lot of that stuff is original works. And frankly, I like to see them try something and take a risk once in a while. I mean, yeah, the adaptation is at least the safe bet. You've got the built-in audience somewhere. But I like to see them stretch their muscles a bit. I'm glad that even though the Power of Anime project didn't work out so well, some of the shows that were released were pretty good, and they took the lessons and used that towards making new original things that were successful.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. The original stuff can soar higher, but can crash harder.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, and adaptations are at least to a point safe.
Yeah, and the adaptations I tend to like are the ones that sometimes take a free hand. Like the Neko Jiru anime is, you know, visually they're very similar, but it's not really much like the manga.
Yeah, the original Full Metal Alchemist, or even to go back years, the Violinist of Hamelin anime adaptation. You know, very different from the manga, such that, you know, much as I respect Madhouse, you don't really need to go and watch the anime adaptations for some of the things they do because it's so respectful, let's say, Monster.
That's the classic example.
Well, Black Lagoon.
Monster is an excellent anime, but, you know, I read the manga first and watched. I lasted about two episodes before it was just like, I know all this already.
I mean, yeah, sometimes they just pull it off so well, like, you know, Kaiji follows the manga exactly, but just the nature of the inherent advantages of the medium, of the tools you get, makes it.
The Kaiji manga doesn't have the narrator.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Wait a minute. Back up for a second, guys. Daryl, did you actually insinuate that the Violinist of Hamelin anime was good?
I like that quite a bit. I mean, I'm a big fan of Yasuhiro Imagawa. It doesn't have an animation budget to speak of whatsoever.
Yeah. Violinist of Hamelin. Yeah, it was a no-budget production, practically a motion comic, but it was really well-scripted and well-paced.
Yeah, I to comment on this, I prefer original stuff, if only because when talking about it, everyone's on the same page, and I don't get the, hey, this show's pretty good, and a bunch of, well, you would have known that if you'd have read scanlated visual novels.
Oh.
If only you'd read the two-channel thread that spawned this. Like, fuck it. Like, I don't swim that deep, guys. Like, I just
if only if only you'd installed the PC game and then the translation patch and then the additional patch to include all the voices.
Yeah, if only you'd pirated 80 hours of material before watching this adaptation, then you wouldn't even need to have an opinion. Like, you would have already known. Like, literally, I had, like, Maoyu. That's, like, the latest example, right? So, like, I gave that show pretty high marks. This is the economics of war kind of Spice and Wolfy type of thing. That's the big hit of this season. And I liked the show. I thought it was pretty good. And I was like, hey, this is pretty neat. You know, let's see where this goes. And a bunch of comments were like, oh, well, you know, apparently it was a novel written with the direction of two-channel users. And and I'm like, look, can I just watch a fucking TV show and comment on it? Like,
yeah, the answer is no. That's why I usually don't say I'm watching a show, because that opens the floodgates for people to spoil the show that you're watching. It just happened to you earlier when you said, I'm watching Penguin Drum. I think the translation's a little iffy. I'm early on. And then people jump in with like the later episode revelations like, dude, I literally just said I'm watching this.
Yeah, people can't help themselves.
People can't help but, you know, throw out their enthusiasm by sharing what made them so enthusiastic about something, though that may, you know, deprive you of the same thing.
And on this subject, people need to understand that an adaptation, even if it is descended from another work, it needs to be able to stand alone. If it cannot stand alone at all, it's failed.
Yeah, I think that value is totally lost nowadays. I think people believe the antithesis. I think people are all about, like, what do you mean? Of course you have to have gone through all of Danganronpa to, you know, appreciate the anime adaptation, dude. Otherwise, you're just, missing out.
Look at stuff like novels, you know, based on Star Trek and based on stuff like, you know, Burn Notice and Monk. You know, you can read the back cover to get a vague idea of who the characters are, then read the book and you know, still have a decent idea of what's going on. And if you can't get that from an adaptation or a piece of entertainment like that, I have a problem with it. If you remember a couple of years ago, my review of the Gundam 00 movie pointed out that just like, no, seeing this is too dependent on the TV series, and it shouldn't be.
Yeah, it should have a basic function as a work of entertainment for people who might be uninitiated with the source material, especially when it's something that literally just, unless you are hanging out in the places where people just devour literally every piece of fan culture that comes out of Japan, there's no fucking way you're gonna know about these light novels or whatever. You can't have read them. Those light novels don't become available here, or most of the time, from what I understand, even get fan translated until the anime's out and is a hit.
So, wasn't one of the early reasons we said there was an appeal of manga over, say, American comic books, was that you weren't really beholden to an immense amount of continuity that you had to know in order to understand the story, even by the slightest? What happened to that?
Yep.
Well,
yeah.
And I consider the stuff like Maoyu to be that's a successful adaptation. I didn't even need, like, people were telling me that after the fact because they wanted to show off that they knew it. That they knew, oh, didn't you know this was a light novel? I didn't need to know any of that shit going into that show. It had nothing to do with anything. Like, the show was perfectly entertaining on its own. I understood everything it was trying to say. It was fine. But, you know, there is a trend of adaptations that don't make a lick of sense unless you've already played the 80-hour visual novel or whatever. original works, I like everyone to be on the same page. Like, hey, we're all starting from the base level here. We're all consuming the story at the same time.
I think that's part of why Madoka was such a big deal.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Absolutely.
Okay, moving on. The Golden Anniversary Twitter account that you guys are contributing to asks, to the best of your recollection, what year from the past This is the ultimate on the spot question that people likely will not be able to answer. To the best of your recollection, what year from the past 5 decades was the best year for anime?
Decades?
Well, because that's what the Golden is counting from 63, the start of Astro Boy, to 2013.
To this year.
My gut instinct, like without thinking, I want to say 1998, just because there were so many big enduring hits of that year.
That's a good one.
Yeah, 1986 was also really big. A lot of really high quality stuff that came out then. Those are kind of just 2 years that spring into my mind, and I'm sure I could look up, if I were to look at the breakdown, I might find some better picks, but those are like my instinctual choices.
My instinctive choice is 2001, because that was the year we got the Cowboy Bebop movie. We got Millennium Actress. We got Metropolis, and that's just my memories of things that were in theaters. I'm now trying to remember like TV shows. That was the year of Fruits Basket. That was the year of the Cyborg 009 TV series that we'll never get to see the end of. Project Arms, which is a favorite of mine that I think is very underrated.
Was it just the dub on that was fucking insane?
That dub was bad because it was a Viz dub.
The dub was real bad. Yeah, it was a Viz dub with lots of weird rewriting. That was when 2001 was when the first series of Galaxy Angel came out. Yeah, see, I'm looking it up now, and yeah, it's confirming. Yeah, that was a good year. A lot of interesting stuff. And that was also right when the boom was starting, because I'm looking at the list of shows that came out in 2001, and man, almost every single one of these got released in the West. Wow. Even Comic Party.
Comic Party.
It's interesting that you mention, one of your first recollections of what made 2001 great was the Cowboy Bebop movie, because one of my first recollections of what made 98 great was the Cowboy Bebop TV series.
TV series, yep.
Yeah. No, I those are good picks. I would go with either of those, yeah.
My pick is 1984.
Oh, yeah.
There were only a couple really, really noteworthy things that came out that year, but they were Nausicaä and the Macross movie.
Yeah.
And I kind of use that as a historical barrier. I think, and when I describe the anime market to Japanese people, everyone's like, well, we have, do Americans like anime songs? We have all these, great theme songs from old Tatsunoko shit from the 70s. And I go, no, basically 1984, anything before 1984 is just impenetrable to most American fans.
You got to tell these publishers to just make compilations of those and just throw them on iTunes. They'll make a little, they won't make much money, but they'll make a little bit, and it's low cost.
The hoops you have to jump through is not worth it.
Bummer.
Sorry.
Okay. I'm actually curious about this. Dodo004 asks, and Justin and I already kind of went over this on our live show from last week, but for Daryl and Mike, your top movies of 2012.
Oh wow!
I didn't see that many. I'm sad to say.
Saw quite a bit. We both saw Haywire. We both like that, right, Mike?
That was last year. That was 2011.
No, that was 2012. Okay. That was January. It was very beginning of 2012. It was like it was like the first 2 weeks.
Limited
of January,
release. Yeah. I want to say that's a movie I saw in like January.
It was the second week of January, because it was on when I did my top 10 on another podcast. My number 10 was these cheap Steven Soderbergh, Haywire, and Magic Mike number 10. It was a real.
You're right. January 20th. It's actually dated as released in 2011. Oh, okay. It had a film festival screening in 2011.
Yeah,
but you're right. We didn't see it until 2012. Well, yeah, that was definitely a favorite of mine. I loved that.
Yeah, I'm real big on counting this. It's a little iffy, but The Raid Redemption was really fantastic. As was its counterpoint, Dread. Yep. Enjoyed the hell out of both of those. Skyfall, really, really good movie.
The one that surprised me that I've gone back to a couple of times on home video and find it holds up and is just really fun and a bit shocking in terms of just how well put together and how studied it is 21 Jump Street.
Oh yeah, that's on my list. Yeah, that was a great movie.
It's such an incredible example of just like, yeah, they fulfill the dream of getting to do high school over again. Only no, it turns out it's awful.
It's also it's. If you're a fan of those guys that made that movie, and they made Clone High and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, they have such a distinct sense of humor that works for me. Like, I think their sense of humor is fucking fantastic, and it's all over that movie. Like, it is that movie is totally by those guys. Yeah,
yeah. I've seen it three times and have just enjoyed it every single time, and found like new things to laugh at every single time too. Yeah.
Yeah, almost every movie I saw theatrically is something I ended up liking, and so I think the last thing I saw theatrically was Django Unchained. Good. I didn't expect to like it as much as I did, but
absolutely fucking triumphant really good movie.
Love that movie.
Though I think my favorite of the year, though, I'm gonna have to revisit it when it does come out on home video. I loved it a lot just for what it was trying to do, and it's just the scope of it was Cloud Atlas.
I've heard my dad just told me hey, did you end up seeing that? You got to see that, and I'll wait for it to come out on video, and because I was just the advertising was so iffy for it, and the Wachowskis, I liked Speed Racer a lot, but everyone is like, I don't know. What is this movie about? I can't tell. And so then when it came out, it was so divided and I didn't see it.
But I mean, it's a Tom Tykwer movie with a side of Wachowskis. The Tom Tykwer, Western audiences will know him from Run Lola Run. But the thing I hear about it a lot is that people are just like, wow, it's so deep and complicated. And I disagree. I thought it was structured very interestingly, but it was straightforward. It was just really ambitious and did a lot of interesting things just visually.
I think anime fans would probably like it more than normal people just because we're more used to slightly jumbled narratives.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of hits we've had are not in chronological order, and so we've got a bit more of a tolerance for it. Right. I'm thinking of other movies, Wreck-It Ralph. I was surprised, by how much I like that one just because... Yeah, I'm not really a fan of Sarah Silverman, but yeah, the movie was good. As far as the big blockbuster stuff, I mean, I thought it was a good year for, the superhero movies. I saw most of those, and as far as my goofy, 80s throwback trash cinema that I'm such a big fan of, that was the year of not just The Expendables 2, but also Universal Soldier: Day of Reckoning. Thank you. Both of those are, fitting the bill. If you're,
yeah, I haven't seen that yet. That stuff needs to come to Netflix. Universal Soldier. Are they?
I don't have Netflix.
Yeah, the last two Universal Soldier movies are interesting because they're, they're shoestring budget, Central European deals, but they're ghost directed by Peter Hyams, and that guy who's directed a ton of interesting movies over the past 30 years. His kid has the director's credit, but it's my understanding that he's the kind of shadow second unit director, and he's responsible for a lot of what makes them so good.
Yeah, speaking of which, I meant to ask Daryl, have you seen Miami Connection yet?
Oh, yeah, I saw Miami Connection years ago. That was one of those things. I would actually show that at panels, and then it never really became the big kind of quasi-cult thing, I guess, until it actually got a showing in New York. But yeah, I'd been following that for a while when the guy found the film print and then they released it for Alamo Drafthouse Films. Yeah, I'd seen it quite some time ago, and I remember showing it to Erin, the Shelf Life columnist, former, and she was like, what the hell is this? And now, obviously, that it's the big hip thing, everyone's all about the Miami Connection. But yeah, those guys live right in Orlando. It's shot, locally. One of the cons that I showed it at, I believe... had the campus for it was used in the film. That was where the ninjas attacked on the University of Central Florida campus. So showing clips of Miami Connection there got over
as ninjas would attack.
Yeah, that tends to happen. Yeah. But yeah, that is a movie that's definitely on my radar, and I'm glad that it got more of an audience. They just had a news report earlier today that unfortunately. Jack Reacher didn't make $250 million. It only made $150, and so it's not going to.
Oh, it's a flop.
Yep,
it's a flop.
But that's a great movie. I was not knowing what to expect. I mean, other than Tom Cruise movie based on some books I never read, but no, really solid. I went to go see it because I'm a big fan of Christopher McQuarrie, and he'd only made one other movie prior, The Way of the Gun.
Mm-hmm. And that's on Netflix.
Yeah, and that movie. Is really great, and Jack Reacher.
If you don't like Sarah Silverman, there's one
that's her
part
best
of
role
Way of the Gun that you'll really like.
yeah, that's her best role in cinema ever, and is the opening scene of The Way of the Gun.
And boo to you for your Sarah Silverman hate.
But yeah, no, Jack Reacher's really solid detective story with that Christopher McQuarrie sort of touch. I hope they work with him some more. I mean, maybe he'll do Mission Impossible 5. Who knows? But yeah, there's ton of those sorts of movies that were good, and then like I said, there's the goofy, crazy, kitschy B cinema that I seem to enjoy a ton. Yep, Ghost Rider definitely. Ghost Rider, Lockout, that was another one.
Yeah.
Safe, starring Jason Statham as himself.
Saw that one.
Stolen, starring Nicolas Cage as himself. Taken 2, which is, hella racist, and I love it.
So racist.
Olivia Megaton ruins movies, but, you can't fully kill them all.
He couldn't quite apply his touch there. That's right. Like, the actors and the material was just a little too good for him to ruin.
Yep, Battleship. That's another one I will not apologize for liking.
That was fascinating. That was such a weird movie. It tried so hard to just bring the board game, bring the mechanics of the board game to life.
Yeah, Peter Berg is a crazy dude. I respect him. Savages. I was surprised because I tend to hate Oliver Stone, but Savages was actually pretty great. I suppose it goes without saying, like, I'm not even bothering to say stuff like Avengers or Hobbit or Dark Knight Rises, because that's sort of like given, right?
If you're saying like favorite movies of 2012 and you said The Hobbit, I would certainly be like, come on, Daryl.
A little skeptical.
I'm just saying, like, movies I enjoyed. I don't know, like, sure. I don't have like a top like, 10 sort of list.
Yeah.
I mean, look,
I enjoyed it.
We're a tough crowd here. If anyone was like, oh, the Avengers was my favorite, I'd be like, oh, come on, dude, really?
Yeah, well, I went through that.
Hey, it was great once you got past that first hour.
Yeah, God.
If I had to pick one from the list, it would probably be The Raid.
I actually agree with you. I just saw Dread, and Dread's really good. Dread's really fun.
Yeah, I need to see that.
That's a good movie. Like, well, it's not, it's a good action movie. It's very entertaining. I was tickled. Start to finish, it was very good.
And before we miss the chance, I have to mention the feel good office comedy of the year, Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I actually don't like that movie, but I'll mention the feel good historical drama of the year, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Did not see that one.
That one is superior to Lincoln.
Wow.
I don't know. Something about Timur Berkmenikov just rubs me the wrong way. I've never liked his movies that much.
I liked Night Watch and Day Watch, so I also liked Wanted.
Night Watch was okay. I couldn't get through Day Watch. Wanted had one part with Morgan Freeman saying, shoot that motherfucker, and the whole rest of the movie just didn't leave an impression.
No, I mean, to me, like, we get to the point where if someone honestly tells me, like, what's the best movie you saw in 2012, and they say Batman, I say, you didn't see any movies. You saw Batman and probably the Avengers and like one or two other things, but you don't actually watch movies. Like,
yeah,
you just watch whatever is the biggest hit and the most marketed, and then that's it. And why am I asking you your opinion at this point? And that's not to be super snobby, but like, I don't understand why people who don't really watch movies bother doing things like a top 10 or something. And their top 10 is just, here were the 10 biggest box office hits. And it's like, man, you don't even watch movies. Why are you bothering with this? I know it sounds elitist, but unless there's at least one like limited release thing on there, it's like, man.
I'm sorry, man. I mean, even the huge, geeked out, camped in line beforehand Batman nerds I know who saw Batman came out of that just going, yeah, it was all right.
Yeah, well, putting that on the top 10 list tells me, like, I don't think you even saw 10 movies.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on. Okay. Trick the TM asks, do you think Discotech only getting Diebuster and not the original means someone else might already have it?
Absolutely. And I think that someone else, it might be an issue on the Japanese side. There might be some names on the production committee of the original Gunbuster that mean it must take a different path to come out here.
Come out here again, anyway, yeah.
Or come out here again, yeah.
I actually think the, Gainax controls a lot of original Gunbuster, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be sucked into the same vortex of animosity that original Evangelion might be in.
My goodness.
Just a theory.
Yeah. But yeah, my theory is that I'm sure if it were available, Discotech or someone else would snap that right up. Just to have it out there on shelves, but it's there's probably some roadblock preventing it from getting out at all.
Yeah,
at the moment.
Okay. Interesting question from Wayne01. If the super nerds were to have a combining robot, which would it be, and who would
Beck Victory Deluxe?
Mighty Orbots.
Mighty Orbots. They're sentient.
I'd be the fat one. I'd be the fat robot that eats everything.
Well, we'd have to be a combining robot, like Justin, pilot.
Justin would be the neurotic one that is obsessed with exercise. And
okay,
you know, I like my Beck Victory Zach, Deluxe you, pick because Zach would be the Marilyn Manson guy.
Zach would be the leader of Mighty Orbots, and I guess Daryl, you'd be one of the girls.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to start.
You don't even know what Mighty Orbots is.
Somewhere Darius Washington weeps.
Yeah.
I know what Mighty Orbots is.
And I know where Darius Washington is.
Mighty Orbots, YouTube it, kids. You'll like the animation at least.
Okay, real quick, let's just do a quick round robin here. Ahava 22 says, you're on the Academy. Vote for Best Picture, Best Director, and Animated Feature. Let's start with Daryl.
Ah, crap.
And just like, your nomination makes it the best picture of the year. Just
all right, Django Unchained.
Okay, Best Director, I assume Tarantino then.
Best Director, good question. I want Neville Dean Taylor to have an Oscar.
Right. So you'd give it to them for Ghost Rider?
That's right.
Okay, hey, look, it's just a fantasy question. So, and then Best Animated Feature.
Wreck-It Ralph.
All right. Mike?
My best picture would be Django Unchained. Best director would actually be Gareth Evans. Because,
for The Raid.
Yeah, The Raid. Because if nothing else, that is a very taut, very beautifully directed movie. Best animated feature. God, that's hard, dude. I didn't see any animated movies this year. Like, none of the ones that are that are nominated are ones that I saw.
You picked a good year to skip them, if I'm being
honest. Yeah, I know. I don't feel like I've missed a whole lot. And I'm going to see all those things when they come out on home video on Netflix. But yeah, I'm going to have to pass on that one because I seriously, I don't think I've seen an animated movie this year.
Well,
in cinemas.
Justin?
Let's see. Best feature would definitely be Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Right.
Love that movie. I've gone on about that at length. Best director, I'd have to give to Tarantino. For reasons. And, I'm in the same boat as Mike, except with the animated features, except I did see Wreck-It Ralph, and I refused to give it to Wreck-It Ralph.
Not a fan.
It's okay. No.
I really think that there would be better movies if I had seen the anime films, because I really want to see 009 Cyborg and One Piece Film Z and Wolf Children, Ame and Yuki, but I haven't seen them. Maybe if I'd seen them.
No, I have to amend that. I did see the Berserk movie, but the thing is, I wouldn't give that the Oscar either.
Oh, yeah, I saw that, and no.
It's well made, but it's just like it's
unnecessary.
It's completely superfluous.
Felt vaguely soulless to me.
Oh, wait a minute. Starship Troopers Invasion. I saw that, too. I guess we can give that an Oscar.
I'll take it over Wreck-It Ralph.
It's weird. It's a weird production. The character designs are really questionable. They're all based on the characters from the Verhoeven movie, and they don't look like them. But you know, as a little OVA sequel thing, it's kind of all right. It's not bad. But, yeah, let's give it the Oscar.
All right. Okay, I guess I would go with, obviously, Django for Best Picture, Director, sure, Tarantino, he doesn't have one of those yet. Animated Feature, that's a category I just, like, this year I was like, okay. Wreck-It Ralph was fine, it was a decent piece of entertainment, but...
Hotel Transylvania, Paranorman.
A lot of people are rooting for Paranorman.
You know what?
Paranorman is actually pretty good, but I haven't seen it.
I didn't see it either.
It speaks to the fact that I liked that movie a lot, walking out of the theater, and then don't have much of a memory of it afterward. But it is a really good movie. I would say it's better than Brave. It's better than Wreck-It Ralph. But I don't know how much of my expectations for Wreck-It Ralph colored my initial opinion of that film. So, sure, Paranorman, I would say. And you know what? Here's what I'm saying. Here's something I would posit. I really hope that the financial failure of Frankenweenie and Paranorman in the same year don't necessarily mean that we're not going to get stop motion anymore, but they do necessarily mean that we are not going to get... The only stop-motion animation that gets produced is Tim Burton-esque horror for kids stuff. Because surely there's something else they can do with that medium. And, you know, Wes Anderson so far is the only guy that's done it with Fantastic Mr. Fox.
And that fell on its face.
And it didn't do that well, but it was at least a really good movie, as opposed to this, like, hey, remember Tim Burton? Yeah, of course you do. Well, he's out every year, so here's the same fucking movie over and over and over again. Hey, look, Nightmare Before Christmas, and that was popular, so here's this. Like, enough with the Tim Burton horror aesthetic. On
the Hot Topic, like, subsidy.
Yeah,
enough. Yeah. It's like, I liked A Nightmare Before Christmas. Like, I kind of liked Corpse Bride, but after that, it's just like anytime I would see a movie with that aesthetic, it'd just be like, you know what? I don't know.
Someone pitched a movie as The Nightmare Before Christmas meets something else. Pick a different movie. But anyway, all right, moving on. Angel XO3 asks, is it foolish to dream that the Sailor Moon reboot will be the series that'll give the U.S. anime industry a much-needed boost?
I think the Sailor Moon reboot, for it to mean something, needs to be on TV, on a channel that the kids are already watching at a time they'd be watching. So unless there was a Disney XD or a Nickelodeon or a Cartoon Network waiting in the wings, the Sailor Moon reboot, like, just streaming alone, that's not going to do it. That needs to be seriously out there to stand a chance.
And there's a very important component of this too that we should take for a given, but we can't. Is it toys? And also the big thing is it has to be good.
I just feel like it would be almost impossible to make bad Sailor Moon.
Oh, it can be done.
It can be done. I mean, we've seen those musicals, or at least clips of them.
We've seen the Saban pilot or the part of it,
the Toonmakers pilot. That's right.
Oh, baby.
The Lightwave demo.
Someone found all the cells in the shooting script for that and has been selling them on eBay for the past couple of months. It's great. Man. They're posting big scans of them and everything.
Every time my friends and I would like talk about, like, oh, let's reenact that, it would never happen because all of us wanted to be the one in the wheelchair.
Exactly. And besides, who would have the time and space to build those windsurfers?
Oh, who knows? But yeah,
those space windsurfers.
Never ask a question.
As far
like
as
that.
A Japanese animated Sailor Moon 2012, 2013, you know, production run, I just feel like the generation of people working in anime now would have some memories of Sailor Moon and be like, "Oh yeah, this was awesome. I'm not going to screw this up."
Yeah, but I think it would need a TV slot where kids could see it. And also where high schoolers and college kids could see it, too. It's like the original one was wildly successful at just getting all those demographics into it at once.
Yeah, and it was syndication, so it was random time slots depending where you lived.
Yeah, and as a result, it was largely luck. I mean, it was kind of this weird thing where the business end of it, although it was able to kind of hold together enough to actually make a marketable franchise, it was never a particularly well-done franchise in the States.
Yeah, well, and here's one point that we're missing is we're talking about Cartoon Network and Nick, and there's one big network that I think more than any other network in North America was responsible for Sailor Moon's success, and that network is YTV.
Yeah, the Canada station.
Yeah, yeah. On pure per capita demographics, anime is actually more popular in Canada than it is in the United States. It's just, you know, there's kind of less people there. But Sailor Moon was a huge hit there before it kind of limped to Cartoon Network or USA Network and kind of caught back up in the States. It's like it was popular enough in Canada that they were making second generation toys even as it was failing in the U.S.
You mean, if I could put this in sort of a macro sense, my hope for the Sailor Moon reboot is that it, A, brings the original show back in some capacity, either on DVD or on Blu-ray, that is available here, and triggers the mass... It's like Sailor Moon nostalgia in terms of shit that's available in stores, and we'll see this resurgence with people in their 20s now and people even in their 30s now. It's like this corked volcano.
Oh, I want to slap the shit out of Toei over that. If you ever want to
Toei's
see something...
fault.
Whose fault is it? Is it Takeuchi?
Yeah, it's Takeuchi.
Kodansha?
Right?
I can't comment, but it's probably one of those two.
Okay, well, yeah. at any rate.
At any rate, one thing I've done a couple of times over the past few months, actually I did it last when Sailor Moon manga started burning up the charts and people started asking, well, why aren't there new DVDs? Just go to eBay and pull up the completed successful listings of Sailor Moon DVDs, and you'll find there are merchants on eBay that are moving between $2,000 and $5,000 worth of bootleg product every week.
Yeah.
And it's just money on the table, money on the table, money on the table. Goodbye, money.
Yeah. Whatever the reboot is, if it's successful, if it's shown on TV here, whatever. Like, I don't think we're ever going to see a Dragon Ball style success for anything moving forward, just because things have changed so much since that was a success. And I don't think that whatever the Sailor Moon thing turns out to be. So we'll see how that actually turns out. But what I want that to do is to remind everybody, hey, remember this huge fucking thing from the late 90s and the early 2000s that everyone lost their fucking minds over that hasn't been available for a decade? Well, here it is again. And money, just open up that fucking dam. Like, let's get that shit coming in.
And that will pave the way for the reissue of Wedding Peach.
That's right.
Yeah, someone's going to dig up those tapes.
It's just not possible for a show to be that successful, I think, with an older teen a preteen demographic anymore. I mean, kids have gotten old in terms of what they like. They turn into man children at about age 7 now.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and once you get to that age, you want pretty much the same thing until you're 40.
Yeah,
you want an iPad and an iPhone.
My 7-year-old nephew is really into Beyblade, and oh man, have you watched the Beyblade cartoons?
No.
It's just like the absolute bottom of the barrel trash animation. It's just one of those, like, even as a big fan of anime, it's just like, oh, I can't watch this. I can't watch this.
Wow.
How does it stack up to Cardfight Vanguard?
I haven't even seen that.
Okay.
I have been warning my brother, just like, yeah, that's it. That might be the thing next year that he's going to want, is Cardfight Vanguard, because I know that's coming stateside.
Yeah, I know that Bushiroad, the company that like makes those collectible card games and the anime and adaptations and stuff, they are positively rolling in it in Japan right now. That they're, you know,
Cardfight Vanguard is huge in Japan at the moment.
Dude, Bushiroad has always had money. Like, having been to Justin and I have both been to Tokyo Anime Fair a couple of times. And even in just those couple of times, it's clear Bushiroad is the company in the room that has more money than anyone else, because their booth is so much more elaborate than everyone else's. And it's just,
I think my favorite Bushiroad trivia bit is the fact that they actually bought a famous Japanese professional wrestling company that's been around for decades. And so nowadays when they promote their huge shows in the Tokyo Dome, there's all this like Cardfight Vanguard cross promotion between like the hardened pro wrestlers and, you know, the AKB48 and the, you know, Breakers band and what have you, but they're driving around the Cardfight Vanguard mobile because that's what brings in the dough.
Yep.
So I mean, I don't know, like, what's it going to take to have something like go huge like that? But how long has Beyblade been just, you know, silently almost grinding it along here in America, making that money?
A decade. That was the funny thing, is like we had a big family gathering at the holidays, and my cousins, my younger cousins, who were all in their early 20s, were seeing this kid playing with his Beyblades and were just like, oh, I remember that. I had that when I was his age. It's like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, whereas a lot of the people who are playing Pokemon now were still playing Pokemon when they were kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah, and like, isn't that whole thing like, people make a big deal out of the fact that, like, most of the people playing Pokemon now are, like, in their 20s. They've, like, graduated college.
It's true.
I don't know why. This is really depressing me.
It is depressing.
And honestly, I think the worst thing is the thought that there is actually an anime so bad Mike won't watch it.
Okay, from friend of the show and Funimation, it's Lance High School. He's got a question for Mike. He says, choose one, anime or soccer? Plus, more of a broader question, how many hobbies can a person truly nerd out on, given the time?
That's an awesome question. Anime or soccer? Well, if you want to see the answer to that question, just go back before 2002 if any of you knew me back before then or saw me at conventions, because that was me like pre-soccer when anime was kind of my big thing. And that was when I was launching Anime Jump and just, you know, immersing myself in this stuff. And at the time, that was great. But once I started getting into soccer, soccer as a hobby is really compatible with, like, you know, world travel and seeking out new cultural experiences. It's made me a much more well-rounded, well-traveled person. At this point, asking me to choose between the two is like asking me to choose food or choose water. If you put a gun to my head,
sounds like you just chose soccer.
Oh no, I was going to say if you put a gun to my head, actually, I'd probably go with the anime, because even now I tilt a little bit towards that. It's funny, my wife, the ex cosplayer, she's a soccer person.
What?
Totally.
I hadn't noticed.
Oh yeah. She's like, she's gung ho. She paints
these.
Yeah, that was sarcasm, Mike.
Yeah, okay. I can't read sarcasm over the internet, even with the tone of voice.
That's all supposed about. But yeah, as far as the other question, how many things can you truly nerd out on given limited time? I think maybe three or four for most people. I mean,
I think you can have small hobbies of like three to five. I think you can only be a true like mega otaku of one or maybe two subjects.
Yeah, because I tend to cycle like on and off. Like I'm immersed in, you know, one of my various interests for a given time, and then a period will go where I just don't even touch it because I've got the other thing I'm big into. And, you know, whether it's anime or video games or manga or comic books or, you know, movies or what have you, you know, I've doing a lot of one at one given time and letting other things be neglected for months, and then I switch up. That's so I guess, you know, it is probably only about one or two.
Yeah. I agree with the three or four thing. And it helps if you make one of these your full-time job. Because if you make one of them your full-time job, then you get paid during the day to do it. And then through your free time, you can do all the other shit. So, like, you know, if I had to count, like, my biggest hobbies, it'd be, like, movies, politics, art, and video games. So those four things. I do all that shit in my spare time. And anime is... what I work with for a living. So, like, you know, of course, like, most of my job is managing people, so it's not like I just get to sit around watching cartoons all day, but...
Yeah.
The best is when you can make one of them your job, and then you can focus on the others.
I agree. I'm really into audio, you know, sound equipment and audiovisual equipment, and guess what my job is? I'm in pro AV.
Totally.
And there are times when that's completely tedious, but no, for the most part, I get to go to work and play with toys all day.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I've always been very wary of making your hobby your job, just because I'm always concerned that, you know, the second it becomes your job may not necessarily always be fun, and then something may no longer be fun anymore, and now you've sort of lost something.
It's a two-edged sword.
Yeah.
Well, Justin's the ultimate example, because at this point, you've turned two of your hobbies into jobs.
Yep. And now I can't stand either. I'm kidding. I really, really enjoy both, but they keep me busy enough that I have no time for the hobby part. So.
Well, no, I mean, you do. I mean, well, I don't know if you consider movies to be a hobby anymore, but it's certainly, you know. I mean, you're still a fan. You still...
Well, no. I mean, I don't mean that I don't have time for any hobbies. More that I don't have time for the aspects of those things that would be hobby. For example, I'm not reauthoring discs so much anymore for fun.
Sure. Well, you turn that into a job.
Right.
Yeah. You don't do the for fun stuff when you have for profit stuff waiting in the wings.
Right. Exactly. I mean, every once in a great while, like, you know, I'll buy the Japanese Blu-ray of Perfect Blue and slap subtitles on there or something. But, you know, for the most part, you know, for fun, no, not so much.
All right. Zump1 asks, any chance of an R1 license rescue for Lensman and Grimm's Fairy Tale Classics? Wait, was
Lensman? Yeah.
That's not impossible.
Yeah, that's not impossible, but it's very unlikely for two reasons. One of them is a question of materials. It's not obvious, but if you go to like Amazon and go to Japanese sites and try to find Lensman on DVD, you won't. It was never released on DVD. There's no DVD-era home video release in Japan, which means that to get a quality release, you would have to hunt down a film copy and do a new transfer of it, which, you know, I'm sure those old streamlined 35mm copies that were, roadshow copies are in great shape, man. So there's that aspect of it. And
then
also
there's the matter of what does the estate think about this film?
Yes. Lensman kind of was licensed by the Japanese company through sort of a backdoor method where they signed a contract for publication and got a bunch of other ancillary rights. The estate didn't really have oversight. And when Doc Smith's daughter, Vera, finally saw it, I think it was at the 1984 Worldcon, she wasn't too happy with it. So that may present a roadblock to getting it released in the West.
Generally I think yeah, action sci-fi stuff is always an easier sell, even if it's something old, than even modern era family children stuff.
Yeah,
it's true we got Grimm's Fairy Tales, courtesy of Haim Saban, but, you know, all that stuff like that, or the World Masterpiece Theater things, those are difficult to see coming out just because there's not a geek/nerd media audience for that. That stuff is meant for television.
Oh, yeah, they'll get less than, you know, if someone fan subs a World Masterpiece Theater show, they are lucky to get like 20 downloads.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's piracy.
Yeah, noticed it. Yeah, I mean, and also with Grimm's Fairy Tales, who even has that? Like, is that still
Disney,
in
right?
Well, as I was going to say, old Saban spun a company back off. So is that still in his portfolio, or is that part of Disney? Or, I mean, in any case, a lot of legwork would be involved. And this is a series that is not really regarded as a classic. I mean, I've seen a few episodes, and it's a beautiful show. It kind of deserves to be, but you know, where's your audience? How are you going to get that out? And how can you make money off of that, man? It's tough. I would say both of those are pretty damn unlikely, and Grimm's is probably a little more unlikely. You know, Lensman, I could almost see down the road, maybe.
Steve Hennell asks, what lessons in digital distribution could manga companies learn from American comics and vice versa?
Wow, that is a podcast subject on its own, because I can talk about that for a while.
But, you know a lot more than I do about it, Daryl. I don't do Comixology or Marvel.com or any of that stuff.
Well, that's interesting to me, because to me, at least in my experience, and based on what I've got, you know, I read comics now just on my iPad. I don't read them anywhere else. Viz's app is great and gives me everything I want.
One Punch Man next week, guys.
I love Shonen Jump. And I'm telling everyone now that I know the secret, it's just like, just subscribe to it. It's $25 a year. And those Yu-Gi-Oh cards, just put them right on eBay. Five or $10 each, and you'll make all that money back.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, and in Comixology is the only way that I read American comics, even though I read very few American comics. I only read what's recommended to me after the fact. But I feel like, generally, in terms of what's available, it's fairly comparable. But maybe I'm totally wrong on that.
I think you're right. I think one of the key advantages of the American side is availability of back catalog. I think another really, really cool thing that the American side has got is the notion of Netflix-style subscription. It's not quite where I want it, something like Marvel Digital Comics Unlimited, where you pay a flat fee and you just get access to like thousands and tens of thousands of comics from the past. Right now, the big impediment to that is that it doesn't work on the mobile devices. But, you know, if they get that going,
Oh, God, huge. They will have my money.
Where manga is really kicking it awesome, especially the Viz app, the notion of download to own, that you buy it and you download it and it's yours. It's not just a rental thing that can be taken away after some point, you know, arbitrarily. I think both of them are starting to really be on the ball as far as the having the releases be simultaneous day and date with print. Where I think the American side really needs to get with it is pricing. I think it's unacceptable that digital comics cost as much as print comics solely because the direct market comic book shops, who know they're running a scam, realize that if digital comics cost 99 cents the way they should, that people are going to stop walking into the Android's dungeon because maybe, hey, the allure of paying that money for 32 pages isn't really as great as they think it is. I would like to see a service that would let you download your comics to own them, have new comics be affordably priced, have the back catalog that should be cheaper than the newer stuff, and also have that Netflix-style model as well for the people who don't want to download to own and just be able to say, you know what, I feel like going back and reading this crazy Silver Age Superman is a dick kind of comics era. And have it at that and be like, yeah, sure, here you go, $5 a month. That's where the digital distribution needs to go. And we're getting there in baby steps, but we're not there yet.
Do you think that they would make more money on a subscription model?
I just look at Netflix, man, and think of like how much money Netflix is bringing in. And I look at iTunes and I think of how much money iTunes is bringing in as far as like their 99 cents for a song. I think 99 cents for a single issue of an American comic length, that's the magic price point, I think, that people would say, yeah, I'd buy that. I think just looking at the fact that there's so much overabundance of all media, not just comics, but, you know, movies and games and what have you, that people are really putting less emphasis on having that physical copy, and that, you know what, just give me the library access. That's the secret behind Amazon and Hulu Video and Netflix and all that success, is that, you know, maybe people don't need to own the entire TV seasons of whatever show. They're good with just going on there, checking out a couple episodes or whatever and saying, yep, I got what I need, and call it a day. I think that's why, you know, the streaming sites and like those big library sorts of setups are taken off as big as they are. And I would love to see comics catch up, but there are some artificially induced barriers, you know, specifically Diamond Distribution and, you know, their whole direct market scam setup that's kind of actively getting in the way of that. Dark Horse was about to implement some of the changes that I'm suggesting until some of the physical comic book stores threw a hissy fit, and then they walked it back, and I was not happy that day.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens with Dark Horse after the Star Wars stuff.
Oh yeah, that other discussion.
Yeah, that's a completely other discussion. But anyway, okay, moving on. Raft of questions here. Aaron Sarais asks, "I'd like to watch more live action Japanese films. Any recommendations? I know Kurosawa and Ozu are musts."
I actually I respect Ozu, but I would probably not really watch him on my own accord. I mean, I understand the history, but I prefer the antithesis of Ozu. I think where the interesting stuff for live action Japanese film is in what would be colloquially referred to as their cult cinema. That's where the entertainment is for me, though, the weird Japan kind of stuff, to throw out a Lisa Katayama phrase, the Tokyo Shock, the Welgo, the Funimation type things. You know, your the modern era stuff would be things like, you know, the Machine Girl and Alien versus Ninja and that sort of crazy, goofy stuff. Go back a few years, Versus. I'm a huge fan of Survive Style 5 Plus. A lot of people are big into the old kaiju era things. Right now, current, like most recent stuff I would think of, the Takashi Miike Phoenix Wright, the Ace Attorney movie. If you are a fan of those games, that movie is terrific. For some more serious fare, I really liked Outrage, the Yakuza film by B. Takeshi. Really good stuff there, and there's a sequel to that coming out. There is a Ken Watanabe remake of Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven. It's called Unforgiven in Japanese, which is Yurusenai.
Yeah, Yurusenai.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to that. But yeah, I guess, you know, there's a huge gamut of stuff. It depends on what you want.
I am kind of more of an animation guy than a Japan guy, I will admit. But I do like some Japanese cinema. I'd say my favorite Japanese films are Ikiru by Kurosawa. That's my favorite Kurosawa film. Just beautifully photographed, very poignant. I like the Battles Without Honor and Humanity series of movies by Kenji Fukasaku. These are just incredibly crazy, chaotic 70s Yakuza movies. It's one of those, you kind of need a map to keep track of all the characters, but it's really just interesting and intricate. And the central guy, who's played by an actor named Bunta Sugawara, is just great. Really fun to watch. And my favorite Japanese movie is, of course, Latitude Zero, which is a crazy sci-fi monster co-production starring a very ill Joseph Cotten and a bunch of Japanese character actors, and Cesar Romero as the bad guy. And he takes his girlfriend's brain and puts it into a flying lion and makes it attack them. They have bulletproof gold suits, and it's a fever dream. It's just great.
My entire appreciation of Japanese cinema is, well, not my entire appreciation. I mean, the person already said, like, Kurosawa and Ozu. Okay, everybody knows those guys. Justin is the person that whenever he says watch this movie, this live action movie from Japan, I do it. And so I'm deferring to him on this one.
Hey, everybody. yeah, my go-tos, especially if you like the artier stuff, definitely Hirokazu Koreeda, his films Afterlife, Maburoshi, more recently Still Walking is amazing, and that's on Netflix. Criterion just put that out not long ago. He just came out with one that got a theatrical last year. I'm blanking on the name right now. Someone in the forums will post it. At any rate, it's his stuff tends to be very kind of just sit back and look at daily life, and as you stare at it, you realize things, not only about life in general, but about what you're seeing, and you know, things reveal themselves very slowly, and the acting is usually just tremendous and just engulfing, and it's like you're seeing reality in his films. Also a big fan of Shinji Iwai, although lately his stuff, he spent about 5 years in the States trying to make a movie in English, and from everything I've heard, it was a complete clusterfuck. That never works, and if you don't know the language, you should not be directing the movie in that language.
Yep.
But at any rate, it's the one film of his that is really, really worth seeing that got released here is called All About Lily Shushu, and that's just possibly the most harrowing being a teenager sucks movie ever made. While being realistic, it's really dark. There's a couple others, but those are my two favorites.
On the subject, you mentioned Criterion, so I'd be remiss to not endorse Branded to Kill, Tokyo yes. Drifter, and also Haosu.
Yeah.
I knew someone was going to bring up Haosu.
Yeah, well, Branded to Kill and Tokyo Drifter are great by Seijun Suzuki, just really unconventional, oddly structured Yakuza films. And they're one of those things that it's just like, yeah, a lot of stuff about Japan in the 80s is romanticized, but Suzuki makes Japan in the 60s look incredible.
Cool. Yeah. All right. From the Omadon, do you prefer to rank and rate anime in terms of objective quality, subjective enjoyment, or
all this guy does is response me to complain about Gundam. I would assume that he knows my answer to this.
Hey, let me tell you guys something. Here is an objective review of the anime canon. The animation was well produced. There were no obvious continuity errors.
Dialogue
was fairly coherent.
That is what people want.
Speaking as your editor, you have positive and or negative adjectives in there, which makes it not objective at all. You just have, like, if it were objective, you would have to say, this show is animated, and then give a plot summary. That's objective. Saying it's well animated is an opinion, and therefore subjective.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
No one rates anything in terms of objective quality.
Yeah.
There's so much. If I didn't already know it full well, I think the top 10 of the 2000s two-parter you guys put out really should have driven home that there's really just no consensus whatsoever on anything anymore as far as what's good, what's not. There was a huge amount of diversity as far as everyone's picks and what people were sending in as their top threes. There's just no way to get anyone even remotely on any sort of baseline at this point. So I'm glad I didn't pick the 2000s to be on.
And on the subject of objectivity versus subjectivity, you know, Roger Ebert has said that reviews are nothing if not subjective. And I also like to pull up something Pauline Kael, the great film critic, always said about her approach to writing reviews, where she would say, well, it's very simple. I go into the movie theater and then I describe what happened.
Right.
And that's going to be different for every person.
Well, describe what happens is often interpreted as this happened and then this happened and then they did this. And that's, you know,
I
don't understand what she's saying.
I should qualify that. I think her actual quote is, you know, I went into the movie and then I described what happened to me.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. Like, that's the quote is describe what happened to me. That's criticism that somehow reviews should be objective or anything like that or you should be objective in your picks, it's just from people who disagree with you. That's it. It boils down to that. It is what I consider to be a fairly childish response to someone else having a different opinion from you.
And yeah, I hear from that guy whenever I say something about Gundam.
Okay, so. Well. But I do like – he gave us another question, which I actually do like. And he said, do you feel guilty or conflicted when you like a show or an aspect of it in spite of many flaws?
Absolutely
I like that
not.
Question. And I mean, yeah, I don't either.
I don't feel guilty. As long as you are willing to acknowledge that the flaws exist and yet you still like the show, I think you're being perfectly honest.
Yep. Hmm. Yeah. To me, it's all about honesty.
There are guilty pleasures.
Well, no, there are. Absolutely. But so long as you say, like, hey, I acknowledge this is not really
you know,
all
come,
that good.
Come to think
really
of it, that's
enjoy.
A misnomer because I don't feel guilty about my guilty pleasures in one bit.
Yeah.
Well,
I've always been so against the term. But.
I was going to say, Daryl, you don't feel guilty about watching Samurai Girls, right?
No, I don't. I mean, it's absolute and totally, like, you know, filthy. But, I mean, it's got
like
a really unique look to it. The fights are actually quite entertaining. There's a
I
lot of, like...
More, I wish it had been more honest and used the title that you suggested, which was, you know, Big Titty Ninja.
Yeah, you know, but the Big Titty Samurai, I'm sorry, yep. Because there's the Big Titty Ninja is what's currently airing right now. But come next season, we get season two of Samurai Girls, Samurai Bride, and that's, you know, Big Titty Samurai one more time. But yeah, I mean, I can perfectly understand why anyone would have huge misgivings of watching that show because, my God, is it exploitative as hell. But I enjoy it, and I'm not going to deny that these things are not totally pandering, but I am a person who will concede if you excel in something that I happen to like, I will like you for it and respect you for it.
Well, and, like, I think the term guilty pleasure still totally applies, and I think that most people who use it understand what it means, and it's not I have genuine deep personal guilt over the fact that I enjoy this show that's silly and dumb.
Shame, perhaps.
Well, maybe it would be. Think of it this way. If somebody else were to walk in and see you watching it, would you be inclined to quickly hit stop or change the channel or what have you? That's really my barometer of it. Do you feel guilt over watching something?
Depends. Is it my dad?
Yeah. If it was your mom watching.
Well, guilt,
like,
and embarrassment.
Hey, what do you got on?
Guilt and potential personal embarrassment are two different things.
Mm.
I think guilty pleasure
maybe
is
just
a catchphrase.
Friend,
guilty pleasure to me just means something I acknowledge as a thinking, rational, logical person. I acknowledge this is bad, but I still really enjoy it, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, like, I watch plenty of TV that, like, if someone were to walk in while I was watching it, I'd be like, oh yeah, well this is dumb, but oh, I enjoy it. Like, you know, there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that it's dumb. It's just, I think for a lot of people, even that simple acknowledgement is some kind of personal weakness or some kind of flaw or a criticism of you. And they can't, like, they just don't want to express that emotion. They don't want to express the fact that something that they're doing might be flawed. I get that a lot. I see that a lot, actually, in the forums. Like, people really don't like to acknowledge that I'm watching something that is not the pinnacle of art. Well, most people do that. Most people don't watch the stuff that's the pinnacle of art. So, you know, it's a little bit of a loaded phrase, but it still means something. And this, the meaning to me is very simple.
I guess where I diverge is that when I say something is dumb, I don't equate it with bad.
Exactly. No, I agree with you.
Totally. Yeah, I just recently marathoned the first season of the show American Horror Story, and that is like the most cheesy, overwrought, you know, telegraphed, overacted, you know, goofy garbage. But I enjoyed the hell out of it.
It's,
especially since I just got to plow through it all at once.
Yeah, you want to talk about goofy?
Oh God,
American Horror Story. Oh.
I felt like half the characters just should have stood around with sheets on their heads, going boo, boo.
Exactly. Totally. I do like that question, and I feel like a lot of this just comes in confidence in your own taste. And it's not like because you watch Buck Wild or Real Housewives of New Jersey, like I do, that doesn't mean you're automatically turned off or won't watch Beasts of the Southern Wild or Holy Motors or The Master or, like, interested in all things. Like, so long as you have a healthy curiosity, I think it's fine. Like, so long as you're occasionally at least going to something you think, like, oh, this might actually have some nutritious content.
I did forget about The Master. I do like Philip Seymour Hoffman and things.
Yeah.
Totally forgot to mention that.
Yeah. Okay. From Chart Knight. How awesome would a show Aikawa-written M.D. Geist be?
I'd imagine it'd be as awesome as Dog Soldier, which he did write.
Well, I mean, it might be awesome, it might not. Show Aikawa generally does pretty good work when he has good material to work with.
He didn't that era.
That's he didn't before he got good material. Let's face it.
Yeah.
You know, when he got the script stuff like Full Metal Alchemist, it was just like, okay, you can handle this.
All right.
Almost everything he did.
I think maybe like when people say like written by Sho Aikawa, they expect like that to carry some sort of like, you know, insert anti-Semitism joke here or something like that. Like that's
That was the one thing. And the thing is, wasn't there Angel Cop manga? Was the anti-Semitism his conceit?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well,
I thought he wrote manga.
He wrote Nadesco, and he wrote Nadesco. He wrote Full Metal Alchemist. That's the kind of stuff I think of when I think of him. Oh, that Neoranga. Did anyone besides me even watch Neoranga?
Yes. I watched
a lot of like dub voice actor people would always play that up, but I never really watched it.
Wasn't that one of the first shows that was like 10 minutes long?
Yeah, it was 10 or 15 minutes. It was almost good. It had a few interesting ideas going on in there, but as a whole, it wasn't that great.
Yeah. Well, he also, I mean, his 80s were pretty rough. I mean, we're talking Violence Jack. We're talking Angel Cop, as we said. M.D. Geist, Orotsuki Doji, Dog Soldier. I mean, these are not good shows.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that he would have made in that era, he didn't do M.D. Geist. I'm sorry, that's a slip of the tongue. But anything that he would have made in that era would have probably sucked. And I don't think an injection of a little bit of weird anti-Semitism makes it more fun.
Yeah, see, I'm pulling up his filmography. I'm trying to figure out what was the last thing he did. He worked on Oedo Rocket. That was a good show.
Yeah, huge bomb.
12 Kingdoms, yeah, that was great.
Oh, yeah, 12 Kingdoms, one of the best shows of the last decade.
Yeah.
And, you know, Yotoden. Any production that recasts, Nobunaga as, you know, an alien or a time-traveling space wizard, I'm down.
Yeah, nowadays Nobunaga is exclusively a cute girl.
Yep.
Sorry.
Okay, a couple of questions left here. Not a couple, about five. Okay, so Jukago asks, how much responsibility for the hype and pretentiousness of...
That's a dangerous word to use on the internet.
Trouble word there.
Almost as dangerous a word as overrated.
Yeah.
Problematic.
That's the other one.
How much responsibility for the hype and pretentiousness of some anime is the creator's fault and not just the fans? That is a loaded one.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to begin on that.
Pretentiousness isn't really a function of the fans, right? That's a conceit of the production.
You're assuming he means pretentious and actually knows what it means.
What the word means.
Yeah, maybe not to insult.
Maybe he's describing the fans as pretentious. I don't know.
No, not to insult this guy, but I assume that he's using that word to mean this show thinks it's so big, which is the way most people use the word pretentious now. You think you're so smart, but you're totally not because yada, yada, yada.
You're not me.
Yeah, because you're not me or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure this question is asking, is the creator at fault when the fans expect too much?
I think if the series is set up in such a way that it makes a lot of promises in the beginning that it's not equipped to deliver on, that's a big source of where this tag comes from. if you've got your show that has all these like vague hints in the beginning of some sort of really sweeping mystery or some sort of like existential sort of plot that ultimately amounts to nothing, then you start getting a, okay, this show is so like thinks it knows what it's talking about, but like the premise of this robotics notes is totally stupid or what. I'm just throwing out an example here, you know, don't harp on me for, you know, hating on whatever show, but you know, yeah, there, that's where I think a lot of that comes from, is trumping up like very, you know, preliminary sorts of things that maybe at the time of writing, they don't have a solution in mind of what it's actually going to be. The, you know, the Lost style writing, as it were.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think it's such a complicated relationship between artists and their audience now that it's really hard to determine who the blame goes to when reaction to it and then subsequent conversation of it and then its eventual creative direction just goes, you know, fucking pear-shaped. It's really hard to determine exactly how that relationship goes, and I doubt there's anyone who's being paid to, like, study that. So, you know, the world may never know. But me personally, I look at that stuff and think, the fans generally are the people who are going to complain the loudest and hardest and be completely unfair to whatever it is they're watching. And I blame the creator the least. Maybe that's just how I am, but I'm not going to blame someone. Like, if they were given creative carte blanche and said, here, do whatever it is you want, and then the fans just react in these horribly unfair, negative, nasty ways to it and call it pretentious and call it, it was just too hyped up or whatever. Like, how much of that is actually the creator's fault? Probably not at all, I would say.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway.
I do not disagree.
Okay, from Ilwu99, I like this question a lot. How do you get out of an anime burnout period?
Not
I'd
watching
love to
anime.
Know the answer to this.
Yeah,
you this, take a break. You take a break. It might be for a day, it might be for a week, it might be for a month, but you step away from it for a minute.
Yeah, and it might be for 6 months. It might be for a long time.
Yeah, I've never, it's never lasted more than a few weeks, but there have been times when it's just like, okay, I can't watch any more anime this month. And then a couple of weeks later, it's like, okay, I'm ready to go back to it.
I've had it last a year. Actually, sometimes I might have had 2 years at one point.
I mean, it's tough for all four of us because we all have professional obligation to watch anime.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, I can watch a couple of things, but I always still feel like, man, the way I define my burnout, and I kind of feel like I'm in a phase of that now, is like I'm unable to think of ideas to do separate from just work. Like, what sort of fan presentation should I do at conventions? And it's like, oh, I'm at a block for that, and I am at a block for that at the moment. And so what I've been doing, I thought I could cope with it by cycling off, not really doing a whole lot of stuff, focusing on some other hobby for a little while. Because I, like I said earlier, you know, in response to Lance's question, you know, I got a bunch of things I'm really into, but only so much time. And I find that, you know, okay, I still watch anime. I still got to. And then there are just peaks in which I'm like, okay, now I'm really immersed in it. And for me, it's doing stuff like this. It's being on the podcast. It's, you know, doing the shows and getting that editing done and all that stuff. That actually keeps me from burning out. But getting the impetus to get up off of the freaking couch and actually just hit play on the goddamn DVD player, that's the effort for me at this point. So how do you do it is, cycling works, but I guess having a support network is also pretty critical, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I honestly, I think, you know, if you're not in a position where you can't not watch it, you have to go back to it. You have to stay in it, like me and like Justin and like Mike and Daryl. You know, you're expected to come back.
Well, fortunately, I only have to do what I ask to do. So right. I'm in exactly. a better position because yeah. I'm a freelancer than
sure.
you guys.
But, you know, speaking as someone who's my whole workday is this stuff, going through burnout is really, really shitty. But if you hold off and you figure out how to manage it, at the other end of the tunnel, eventually something's going to pull you back in and you're going to remember. And I guess I'm just lucky in that there have been just enough things that will be like, hey, here's something you're really interested in, and then I'll go back to that, and then I'll say, like, oh, now I want to see all this other stuff. Like, it something just has to basically, you know, push the key, turn the car on, and suddenly you're back. But eventually you get tired of driving, and you pull off the side of the road. Kind of a shitty analogy, but, you know, eventually you want to turn the key again and get back into it.
It always boils down to car analogies, but sure. Yeah, I agree.
Yes. Yeah, right. Ben the Bear asks, I like this, deep down, is Miyazaki tsundere for John Lasseter?
Miyazaki only has one waifu, and that is Bai Niang from Panda and the Magic Serpent.
Yep, he said so himself.
If you read his autobiography, Starting Point. The chapter where he describes how he invented moe, he went back to see Hakujoden, Panda and the Magic Serpent, like 8 or 10 times because he was really into the girl character who turns into the snake.
Yep, it's all in there. I bought that book and it is awesome. I wish we got the next part of it. Nonstop. You know, Everybody Sucks But Me by Hayao Miyazaki. And that's why I think Miyazaki might not be tsundere from John Lasseter, because that would have to mean that deep down inside, he truly loves him. When in fact, we all know that Miyazaki is looking out for number one at all times. And when he dies, they are going to encase the entire Studio Ghibli in concrete and bury it and have that be his tomb, because no one is coming out of there alive once he's gone.
Yeah, I would argue that Miyazaki is not anything for John Lasseter. However, John Lasseter is super moe for.
Oh, totally.
John Lasseter.
Totally. Like, I mean, the times I've heard Miyazaki in interviews talking about coming to the U.S., he seems vaguely resentful about that he has to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I if John Lasseter does not have a Miyazaki hug pillow, I'm shocked. Shocked. Or like some kind of boob mouse pad.
We all love Miyazaki and respect his accomplishments, but just remember that about 2/3 of Ponyo, that was his disaster porn. That was him destroying civilization.
That's what he wants. Yeah.
That is exactly what he wants.
Okay, so we got a couple of email questions here. We're almost done. V-Guy sent in some stuff. Haven't heard from him in a little while. These are okay questions, so I wanted to get to them. Section 23 has just acquired Pat Labor OVA series. Any plausible chance that this may lead to them releasing the movies? You've spoken very highly of Pat Labor 2. Did the movies do well in Japan to the point that they'd still be astronomically expensive, or is even a semi-plausible possibility in the future that they may be released here provided the OVA sales figures do okay?
I think Pat Labor is probably in the past enough that Headgear might have, you know, gotten it into their heads that, you know what, we don't have to turn down the release of things anymore or hold out for, you know, the big payday. I certainly think that, yeah, if these OAVs do well, the rest of Pat Labor, as far as I can tell, has been released on Blu-ray in Japan, so the materials exist.
That's the big factor, is that the Pat Labor movies have been out in Japan for a couple of years now. So the Headgear will feel safe, setting them out to other markets where they'll be available cheaper.
Licensor is actually Tohoku Shinsha, the studio.
Oh, okay.
I think this is probably them, Tohoku Shinsha, dipping their toe in the water, because when CPM was wrapping up the shitty work that we had done on the series, we asked if they wanted the dub tracks, and they said, oh no, that's not necessary. Bandai Visual USA is going to be taking care of us from here on out. I don't think that story ended how it thought it was going to end.
Yeah, wow.
And so they have probably been licking their wounds about that ever since.
So I understand the timeline on that, right? Didn't CPM finish Pat Labor TV and then Genion released the third movie? Or do I have that mixed up?
Something like that. It was fragmented.
Yeah, it was around the same time.
That Pat Labor Wasted 13 was like 2000 or 2001.
Yeah, right, we would have been working on that Pat Labor into 2002-ish, 2003. So that I mean, we were putting those shitty DVDs out for 2 or 3 years. So there it would have been somewhere in that timeline. And at any rate, so my guess is that enough time has passed now that Toho Shinsha is like, well, we could try again. Let's just try one thing, see if it catches fire, and we'll see where it goes from there. So who knows?
Okay.
Say, if you want Pat Labor movies, I'd say, you know, go out there and get that Blu-ray, man. It ain't that expensive. Blu-ray. The Sentai Filmworks OVA Blu-ray.
Because the Japanese Blu-ray was actually clearly made to be an Oniamis release here that never got imported.
Oh, really? So it has subtitles and the Elastic Media dub and all that stuff? Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
Fully bilingual menus. Has the original audio track as well as the re-recording? I believe that's also the case.
Yep, fully bilingual menus. It is clearly meant to have been an Oniamis release. Both movies. Wow.
Well, what might have been?
Yep.
It's weird to have...
money.
It's weird to have a V for Vendetta guy question that isn't broken out across 30 tweets.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. And hey, he's got one more, and neither of them are about Evangelion. He also asks, Section 23 also recently acquired Tokyo Magnitude 8.0, a series about children caught up in an earthquake hitting Tokyo. The series aired in Japan 18 months before the giant earthquake. Haven't seen a review by any of the series. That's because it hasn't been available legal. Is it a tasteful action-adventure series in light of the recent natural disasters that struck Japan, or is it some sort of overly sensationalized gloss filled with plot contrivances? Now, Justin, you and I both talked about watching this for the Revenge of the 2000s show.
Yeah, I couldn't get through much of it.
I couldn't either. It is
not good.
I would say not only is it not particularly good, in light of that earthquake, not particularly tasteful either.
No. It is tragedy porn. It's like a made-for-TV movie. Yeah.
It's really. Very, like, hooray for the indomitable Japanese spirit, you know, kind of show. And it's also built on the concept of everyone thinking such an earthquake of this magnitude is completely impossible, whereas the actual earthquake that happened was actually worse than 8.0. But, yeah, it's – I don't know. I couldn't really get into it. I was hoping for it to be a better show than it was, given the talent that was behind it. But
I didn't see it. I know that that Neil Nadelman translated it. My friend who lives just up the road from me, and he didn't have a lot to say about it, which that generally indicates that it's average. It's not great. So it's hard to tell.
I think it's less about the earthquake and more about, hey, teenage girls, quit being so shallow.
Okay.
That seems to be the message that it was really going for. It's been years. I didn't really go back to revisit that show ever.
I do think it's interesting that Sentai are kind of mining, like, you know, 2008 through 2010 for all these weird shows that that kind of got lost in the shuffle. They're coming out now, like that. And they announced a couple of other shows, like Achikochi and a couple of other things from like 2009 and 2010 that kind of surprised me.
Maybe stuff that they meant to license back when...
Yeah, and the shit was hitting the fan.
Back when, yeah, exactly. There was a definite splatter on that fan. All right. Paul Bremer asks, are there any recurring themes, tropes, or cultural elements in anime and manga, excluding peculiar subcultural fixations like Emoto shows, that you find alienating or frustrating?
Well, there are so many peculiar subculture tropes that get put into anime that when you put them all together, it becomes... That's what makes it alienating, is that there are so many of these different groups that all are fixated on their specific thing, whether it's a girl with an eye patch or, you know, the little sister character or, you know, you name it. That's what is collectively making anime impenetrable, you know, so to speak.
Yeah. And I you've talked about this before, too, Daryl. And I feel like the target audience at this point, or at least a large portion of it, is older, and so they need to move away from high school stuff. I feel like the medium in general, like, I don't know if it's an aspect of the audience or the people creating it, it's just obsessed with high school. And I remember
specifically anime high school, not like a high school that is like a real thing, because that fascinated me about Kids on the Slope, is that for all its setting about being in the 60s, why is high school in the 60s virtually identical to contemporary high school? And it's because it's anime high school, which is some weird idealized thing that probably doesn't exist the way we think about it despite the fact there being all these shows about the school festival. And
yeah, it's not just anime and manga that's like that. I mean, a good chunk of Japanese TV dramas are like that too.
And and you know, you know the great manga Resentiment by Kengo Hanazawa. I think that skewered the whole high school thing like really, really expertly, really brutally.
Oh yeah, I love it. And it's unfortunate that it never got picked up for release here, but it's out there. Justin's right. I mean, I know I've heard all the explanations of like, oh well, these were the last times people were truly free, blah blah blah. But dude, pick another tune. And yeah, as far as all the other otaku-ish stuff, if that's off the table, I'd have to say, yeah, let's get some adults in anime a little more often, as opposed to the 14-year-old who's average in every way, quote unquote, protagonist. I've seen that show enough. Thank you.
Okay, and we're gonna go ahead and call it here. This is gonna be our last question. From Paul Brummer, he says, since Nozomi has managed to land Rose of Versailles, are there any other great whales like that other than Legend of Galactic Heroes? And I'm just going to go ahead and throw Sailor Moon in here as well. Left.
The Macross movie, Do You Remember Love?
Future Boy Conan.
Macross
Best anime
7.
TV series ever made, and we don't got it.
Yeah, a lot of people would always say Future Boy Conan and Space Pirate Captain Harlock, and hey, guess what? I think we are getting Captain Harlock, aren't we?
We're getting Captain Harlock from Discotech. Still nothing on Conan, and that's one of those things that will eternally frustrate me, because it's just like, yeah, there are a couple of kind of odd little entanglements to it, but it's just like, can't you just spend the money, put Hayao Miyazaki made this on the cover, and, you know, print money?
Isn't Hayao Miyazaki the Gensakusha, the original creator?
He very well might be.
Future Boy Conan?
No, that's
Alexander Key.
Yeah, it's adapted from that, but I know that I wasn't sure if enough had been changed that it was considered like a Miyazaki's thing. But yeah, the key novel, not that kind of key novel, Mike, but that is the original source material.
Yeah, if Miyazaki has to sign off on that, we are fucked for until he dies.
Yeah.
If not, it's someone just needs to talk to Nippon Animation and. I don't know that they actually have a dedicated licensing person anymore.
And the other wrinkle is the Key novel was from the, I think, either late 60s or early 70s. But the thing is that that's still active intellectual property. So it would need to be, his estate would have to sign off on it too.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's going to be a tough way. I can't imagine any other shows that are that big of whale. I mean, we're talking
Zeta Gundam, Justin. No, I'm just messing with you.
Well, you know, even these old shows like Rose of Versailles, I mean, that's not going to be a huge seller. It'll sell probably okay, but it's not going to, you know, break records.
Yeah, I mean, as long as it sells okay enough that they maybe look and say, okay, this did well. What else we got? Oh, Brother Dear Brother. Well, we already got it subtitled because of Vicky. We can throw that out too. You know, I'm just speculating as possibility here, but that
those Vicky subtitles are just transcribed fan subs.
Yeah, pretty much. But, you know, hey, they've got a ton of weird stuff that, you know, you wouldn't otherwise have been able to get, and it seems to be opening the gates to some amount of physical releases. Now, I'm not saying we're going to get our Don Dracula box set anytime soon, but I'm sure Mike would buy it.
The one I want is the all the weird TV movies that Tezuka did in one box set. You know, Marine Express, Bremen 5, and Bremen 4, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and those are on Vicky as well.
Yes, they are, and you should watch them. They're not all great, but they're all very interesting.
Yeah, the last mystery of the 20th century is not currently on Vicky. I just checked right before the show started.
I'm not real sure that officially came out on home video. I know that I have a feeling that like the bootlegs that are out in other regions may be, you know, taped off the air kind of deals. But I don't think I've been able to source a copy of that in Japan.
I mean, short of stuff like, you know, the super, like, old classic stuff that, you know, Japan likes and, you know, we would never care about. I'm talking like the Star of the Giants or Tomorrow's Joe or Attack Number One and Aim for the Ace and that kind of stuff.
You will never sell those here, ever.
That's exactly what I'm getting at. It's like I don't see those being available even with the stuff we've got currently, but... Hey, never say never. I would have had Cobra on that list too, and shows how much I know.
Yeah, it is kind of a never say never thing, but at the same time, like I, you know, if this guy's talking about like shows that U.S. fans have been asking for nonstop for years and years and years and years and years, I would say at this point we've got most of them. Legend of the Galactic Heroes being the lone standout. Who knows if that's ever going to happen, but yeah,
it came close to happening. It still could.
It still could. Who knows? Maybe next.
LGH and Macross, those are like the big outstanding, like, hey, we don't have it kind of titles.
What are you talking about? They totally licensed that for iPhone download.
Good grief. Oh, boy.
Okay, and with that, I think we are done here, gentlemen. Thank you so much for participating in this extraordinarily lengthy edition of the Super Nerds show, and we really do appreciate Mike and Daryl and Justin. You stuck around this whole time. Really appreciate it.
Hey, this isn't even 3 hours. It's not long. See, now that you're over the 2 hour mark, you know, consistently, there more and more people are going to be like, "Well, why isn't it 3 hours?"
Oh no, no, we don't consistently do shows that are 2 hours or more.
Oh, it's just the ones that I'm on.
Yeah. Well, yep. What does that tell you?
It tells me, shut up, Mike.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for showing up. We really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Yep. See you later.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Justin, Mike, and Daryl for stopping on by. Theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.